The Solemn Monster sounds off.
200.
That's a magic number.
So in closing, Michael Jackson is dead. Let him rest in peace. Let him be buried. And let life go on. There's more important news in the world that we need to know about instead of knowing what killed Michael Jackson. Because quite frankly, I don't give a shit. Really hardcore, diehard, lifelong TNA fans are like abuse victims. They're like the victims in an abusive relationship. They consistently get the shit kicked out of them. They get smacked around. People try to convince them they have to get out of this relationship. It will not end well. It will not go anywhere. And these people make up all the excuses in the world and they stay in that relationship. That's exactly what TNA fans are. They are abuse victims who don't know any better. Some people are into that sort of thing. Well, hey, some people are into snuff films. Some people are into necrophilia. Some people are into bestiality. To me, she looks like something that you'd have to kill in a video game to advance to the next level. Well, do you have a mustache or not? Look in the fucking mirror. I think it's pretty obvious that you have a mustache. Russell writes in, as far as we know, The Rock is in good physical condition, relatively injury-free, and 38 years old. Obviously, the money match here would be Rock versus Cena. My question is, what do you think are the odds of this happening? 0%. Rock is one of those guys, I'll take him at his word when he says that he's done, he's not coming back to wrestle again. Wrestling John Cena, it's not going to happen. I agree, it would be a huge match. Him and Rock would do big business together, but it's just not going to happen. I would put that at 0%. It drives them nuts. It drives them nuts because they're drinking the Kool-Aid, and I'm not. I mean, to say that somebody beat this show over the head with an ugly stick would be an understatement. It got beaten over the head with a flaming ugly stick wrapped in barbed wire. Matt Hardy made his TNA debut, his long-anticipated TNA debut, at their Genesis pay-per-view last weekend. Everybody in the world didn't want to touch this guy with a 10-foot pole. You knew Dixie Carter would because they fucking hired Kurt Angle. They hired Jeff Hardy, who was under indictment on drug charges. These people don't give a shit. They're the only ones in the world that would have touched Matt Hardy with a 10-foot pole. And then he would have taken that pole and shoved it right up their ass, which I think is what he's going to end up doing anyway. This guy's going to end up doing something to embarrass this company. He talks about how it's all about drawing money. And if you don't draw money, then you don't belong here, brother, brother, brother. I mean, Orton was over like Rover when this whole thing was over, and just rhymed. Holed up in his mansion, apparently with a briefcase full of bricks of cocaine, smoking crack, and having these orgies with all these porn stars. They'll give you the did you know fact. Did you know that this person has more Twitter followers than this? John Cena has more Twitter followers than Gandhi. You know, when they started going back and forth with, you know, Riley and Randy and Jimmy, obviously someone in the back is a fan of Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd. And I happen to be a fan of Bugs Bunny, too. Don't get me wrong. You know, and the Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote. Guess what? If I wanted to watch cartoons, I'd set my alarm for 7 o'clock and wake the fuck up on a Saturday morning. That company fucking sucked. Their TV show was unwatchable. It reminded me of Impact in how bad it was. It was an awful, awful television show. They took their main storyline, which was already convoluted and illogical enough as it is, but still showed some signs of life, and they put a pillow over its face and smothered it to death.
This is Tim Arson, the arsonist, El Perro Maniaco. You're listening to The Sound Off with the Sound Monster. Oh, I screwed it up. The Solo Monster.
Solo Monster, there you go.
Solo Monster. Solo Monster. This is Tim Arson, a.k.a. El Perro Maniaco, a.k.a. The Arsonist, and you're listening to The Soundmaster. What's the name of the show? I'm sorry. I'm so fucking retarded.
Hi, wrestling fans. This is George Napolitano, and you're listening to The Sound Off with The Solomon. Missed it.
Listening to The Sound Off with The what?
Solemonster?
The what?
Salo Monster.
Okay. Hey, guys, this is Jay Lethal, and you're listening to, and I forgot the line.
Hey, Solo Monster. It's the sound off. It's the sound off. It's the sound off. Making his way towards the ring, weighing 95 pounds, soaking wet, hailing from parts unknown, the reigning world heavyweight champion of podcasts, the Solo Monster.
I am the Solo Monster.
Welcome to the bicentennial edition of the Solo Monster Sounds Off, episode 200 here on SEScoops.com. It is Sunday, January 8th, 2012. I am the Solo Monster. First things first, I gotta say thank you to everybody listening to this show right now. Without your support, without you downloading and commenting and recommending the show to other people, we never would have gotten to 200 episodes, so a hearty thank you to the Sound Off universe out there. And also, I want to give a shout out to one of our own, Brass Tacks Artist Producer, who you may recognize that name from Facebook. Brass Tacks is the real deal, everybody. He is a record producer. He's a very talented individual, and he was also kind enough to assist with part of that intro. That last part of the intro there that you heard was his voice. And actually, the last 30 seconds or so that you heard there is going to be our new permanent intro to the Sound Off going forward from episode 201 onward. So I want to give a big thank you to him. His help was very much appreciated. And it always helps to have somebody as talented as him being a real record producer and all that, help out with the Sound Off. It's a really cool thing, so I wanted to say thank you to him. And you'll be hearing his voice at the beginning of pretty much every Sound Off going forward, with perhaps a few exceptions if I want to have a funny intro or something like that. But I've been wanting to have something a little more permanent for a while. He made the offer, and one thing led to another, and there you go. So big thank you to him for that. What we're going to do this week is what we've done every single week. I didn't go out of my way to plan something, different. I'm going to do the show the way that I always do the show, because that's why you people listen to it. Otherwise, you would listen to something else. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about Raw. I know there's been a lot of talk and discussion about Chris Jericho's big comeback to WWE. Some people loved it. Some people hated it. Talk about that. We'll talk about some interesting TNA news as well. Some superstars have contracts coming up here in 2012. Could there be some TNA talent on their way to WWE? And of the ones who potentially could come over, which ones do I think WWE should take advantage of, and which ones do I think WWE should pretty much ignore? So we'll talk about that, and also we're going to have a big mailbag this week. I didn't do one last week with my 2.5 hours worth of episode 199, the 2011 year in review, which, by the way, thank you guys for the feedback. Got a lot of good feedback from you guys who liked it, and I was hoping you would, because if you didn't, I would have felt very bad, considering I spent many hours recording and editing and uploading and all that good stuff last weekend. So you seem to enjoy it. Maybe we'll do something like that every year, but I did not get to do a mailbag last week, so as such, I'm backlogged with a lot of questions, and on top of that, a lot of you guys wanted to try to get your question asked on the air here on episode 200. I won't be able to get to everybody. I'm going to get to as many as I possibly can, so I want to dedicate a nice chunk of this week's show to your questions, so we'll get to all that. First thing I want to mention, though, before we talk about Raw, I've got to talk a little bit about SmackDown here. For those of you who may have missed SmackDown this week, go check out the main event. Daniel Bryan against The Big Show for the World Heavyweight Championship. Actually, SmackDown had two big matches this week, both of which were pretty good, especially the Intercontinental title match between Cody Rhodes and Booker T. This was the rubber match in their series. Of course, Cody beat Booker on pay-per-view. Booker then beat Cody on Raw a couple of weeks ago. So this was the rubber match for the title, and Cody Rhodes is, in fact, still the Intercontinental champion, as he should be. But the reason for these two big matches on SmackDown this week, apparently, WWE felt they had to give the fans something big in the absence of Randy Orton, who, of course, continues to nurse his back injury. Hopefully, he'll be back in a couple of weeks. So they gave a world championship match away for free on SmackDown this week. Daniel Bryan against The Big Show. The match itself was not wasn't that good, quite frankly. And that's in large part because they didn't really give it a lot of time. And the match and the finish and everything was really designed to feed into an ongoing storyline, hence the screwy finish. So the match really was nothing special, even though I did like it in the context of the storyline. But the real reason to watch this thing is for the commentary of Mark Henry. This man is my new hero. In fact, he gets this week's sound-off salute right off the bat. The sound-off salute goes to Mark Henry this week. He put Michael Cole in his place at the start of that match like no one else has to date. I mean, it was a thing of beauty. Cole was ragging on Daniel Bryan, as he usually does, and, you know, talking about how he can't believe he's the world champion and doesn't deserve to be the champion and blah, blah, blah. And here is the exchange that followed between Michael Cole and Mark Henry.
So, Mark, I gotta ask you, who would win a matchup between Daniel Bryan and Hornswoggle?
I can't believe you asked me a dumb question like that.
Well,
what relevancy does that have to me being out here and me not having that title? You tell me.
I guess none. I apologize, Mark. I mean, just trying to, bring a little.
If you don't have nothing smart to say, don't say nothing at all.
Was that not the greatest thing you've ever heard? This was my favorite moment of the week on any wrestling TV show. Raw, SmackDown, Impact. This was awesome. Even better as the match progresses and it went on. You know, Mark Henry actually did something that you don't see. Not just Michael Cole. You don't see very many announcers on WWE television do these days. He actually puts over the talent. He put over Daniel Bryan. He talked about how Daniel Bryan actually impresses him. Obviously, he has something. There was one part of the match even where Daniel Bryan fell out of the ring or got thrown outside, and Mark Henry kind of stood up and was yelling at him with this great intensity to get back in the ring and, you know, be a man, get back inside. But he was actually putting over talent during this match. So in the time span of 6 minutes or so, Mark Henry proved that he is in fact a better announcer than everyone else employed by WWE. You've just got to check out that main event for that, if nothing else. I mean, it's just, it was great. And Mark Henry, we salute you. The first Raw of 2012, emanating from Memphis, Tennessee, took place last Monday. This was the big show with the Mystery Man, who was supposed to be revealed. It was a show that will be remembered for one reason, that, of course, being the return of Chris Jericho. You either liked it, you hated it, as I said earlier. Much like that Kane promo last week. It was a very polarizing segment, at least amongst internet wrestling fans. Beyond that, there really was nothing on this show that was terribly newsworthy, terribly exciting. I would love to sit here on this, my 200th show here, and talk about how the first Raw of the new year was this great show that got 2012 off to a roaring start, but that would be about as true as me saying that Chris Jericho has good fashion sense. I love Y2J, but my God, what was up with that jacket? I mean, really now. I mean, I know it's part of an angle this time, but that still doesn't excuse that vest he wore for his last return in 2007. Jericho's fashion sense is suspect at best, and we'll get to him in a little bit. Let's do the good, the bad, and the ugly this week. There was quite a bit of both on this show. Let's talk about the good. We'll start with the good stuff first. We'll stay positive. The only good thing, actually, from John Cena's promo was his Christmas creature reference. I thought it was very clever on their part, mentioning that, seeing as how they were in Memphis, and he is feuding with Kane, after all. For those who have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about, I'm pretty sure I mentioned about two sound-offs ago the fact that Kane played a character called the Christmas Creature back in the early 90s in the old USWA promotion in Memphis. So again, I thought that was pretty clever on their part. Throughout the night, we had segments on the show where Miz was terrified of being attacked by R-Truth, and really, who wouldn't be? I mean, he's a crazy man who talks to himself and smacks people in the head with a water bottle. I run into people like that all the time on the subways in New York City. He complained to Johnny Ace. Later on, he was asking the Bella Twins, Miz was, if they had taken a break from screwing insert random superstar name here long enough to have seen R-Truth, which, of course, they had not. But they did say they saw Little Jimmy. I bet they did. How sore must their lady parts be, by the way? The Bella Twins. Did I just say that out loud? Sorry. I don't know what got into me there. Anyway, the Miz had a brief match with Sheamus that ended when R-Truth attacked Miz. I like this only because they finally embraced Miz as a chicken shit heel instead of trying to convince us that he's actually tough and intimidating, which is not a role that suits him very well. I like Crazy R-Truth, but the water bottle thing has got to stop. I mean, at least if he was hitting people right in the eye with the water bottle, you can make the argument that he's actually hurting people. But you can't fake hitting people in the eye with a water bottle. So when he hits them in the head with it, and they still have to sell for it, it badly exposes the business. But then again, you know, they did this on a show where one man tried to literally drag another man to the fiery depths of hell. So realism be damned. And, R-Truth also quacked like a duck at one point. My favorite part of the WWE Championship match was the backstage promo that came after the match, involving CM Punk confronting John Laurinaitis for costing him the match against Dolph Ziggler, which I'll talk about more in a bit. Laurinaitis announced that Ziggler will receive another title shot at the Royal Rumble, and skateboard Johnny Ace himself is going to be the special guest referee. And Punk followed that up with the line of the year so far by saying that he might be arrested for animal cruelty because if Ace tried to screw him, he was going to beat him like a bitch. That was not PG. They're building this nicely. I'm actually excited to see the eventual match between Punk and Laurinaitis. I guess the only question is, when do you do it? You know, I mean, would they actually have the balls to do CM Punk against Johnny Ace at WrestleMania? My guess would be no. You know, they like having a good championship match featured on the show, and I assume that the Chris Jericho storyline is leading him to a title shot at WrestleMania. Otherwise, I don't know what you'd do with Jericho. So you could do Punk and Johnny Ace maybe at the Elimination Chamber, possibly, if you keep Punk out of one of the Chamber matches. I could actually see that. I think on the Elimination Chamber show this past year, Miz was he was not in a Chamber match. I believe he was defending the title against Jerry Lawler. So you know what? I could easily see Punk and Laurinaitis, as opposed to doing Punk and Ziggler Part 3 at the pay-per-view next month. I guess we'll find out. Let's talk about the mystery man, shall we? Let's get to this part of the show here. You'll notice this is in the good column this week. To the surprise of no one, the mystery man turned out to be none other than Sting. No, I'm kidding. It was Chris Jericho, yet another wrestler, besmirching the good name of the state of Hawaii. First Bret Hart, then CM Punk, now Chris Jericho. Why does no one actually want to follow through on their promise and visit the great state of Hawaii? I think I may have to pitch for Webmaster Mike to send me there on a fact-finding mission to see what the problem is. I promise to report back with my findings. We got one final creepy vignette on the show with the boy and the girl, which I love, by the way. I'd like to think that this will somehow play into the storyline at some point, but even if it doesn't, these promos were just so well done. I mean, they did exactly what they were intended to do. They created a buzz, and they got people talking. So, I could have done without the camera-shaking effect at the end there. You know, it was like Blair Witch on Fast Forward. Not good if you have motion sickness. Anyway, Jericho got a very nice reception from the crowd, considering the last time we saw him, he was a dastardly heel getting punted in the skull by Randy Orton. He appeared on stage wearing an absolutely outrageous sparkling jacket. So outrageous, in fact, that if WWE was to start selling these things online, I'd probably cave and buy one myself. You know you would, too. They can make a killing off those things. You kidding me? Until they start short-circuiting, of course, and setting people on fire. Jericho was smiling from ear to ear, soaking in all of the adulation from the fans and behaving like he was Lionheart Chris Jericho from his old ECW and WCW days. And this segment went on forever and a day. I mean, it just would not end. And you've never seen a wrestler milk a crowd for as long as Jericho did here. He put Hulk Hogan to shame on this show. And he would leave the ring to slap hands with the fans and then get back inside, play the different sides of the arena, just like Hogan did at WrestleMania 21, if you go back and watch that. And then he would pretend like he was about to say something before exiting the ring again and slapping hands with the fans at ringside again. And, he started mumbling things that didn't even sound coherent. I thought he was having a stroke. Finally, he got back in the ring, held the microphone up to his mouth, and then in a very heelish manner, just dropped it on the ground. And for a moment there, you thought the turn was coming, but then he just started hamming it up again and pumping his fists in the air. And then he just left the ring, walked up the ramp, stood there with a smile on his face that just screamed, "God, you people are fucking pathetic." And then he just walked off. And I will admit, when I first watched the segment, I had no idea what to make of it because it completely caught me off guard. I mean, I was expecting him to appear
at the end of maybe the Punk Ziggler match and return as a heel. So when he came out for some random segment at 10:30 p.m. as a babyface, I was just confused. And the first time through, I was not a fan of this at all. It felt uncomfortable, quite frankly, watching him kill the crowd like that. And then I went back and I watched it again. And this time, I studied him more. And I realized that he had indeed just trolled the entire audience. He took their excitement and their enthusiasm, and he strangled it until there was nothing left. And that's exactly what Chris Jericho's character would do, because the last time we saw him, he was the ultimate bad guy douchebag. You know, he would come out every week and insult the fans, he would call them parasites and whatnot, and he had no redeeming qualities about him whatsoever. Why then would he come back like the old Y2J? I mean, we see it all the time in wrestling, the lack of consistency and continuity in storylines. But you know that if Jericho is back, he's going to have some control over his storylines, just like he did last time. And suddenly it all made sense to me. It was different. It was unique. I see people saying that he walked out a babyface and walked back as a heel. What a brilliant man. The people saying that don't get it. He never was a babyface. It reminds me of the movie Primal Fear. It was a movie with Richard Gere and Edward Norton. I think it was actually Ed Norton's first major movie, in fact. And in the movie, Ed Norton plays this great troubled teen who kills a pastor, if I remember correctly. And you know, but seemingly he suffers from multiple personality disorder. And he gets represented by Richard Gere's character, who's an attorney. And the movie has a fantastic plot twist at the end that I don't want to spoil. But those of you that have seen it probably know why I would mention it here. Jericho turned the people against him without ever uttering a single word into the microphone. And I don't think he's going to speak again this week on TV either. At least I wouldn't if I were him. I'd milk this a little bit more. I mean, that's the beauty of it. That interview that he did on WWE.com where he refuses to answer any of the reporters' questions and just keeps smiling, and then the guy asks him if he's going to be in the Royal Rumble, and Jericho stops, turns the lights on his jacket on, smiles, and walks off, was just so, so great. I mean, that was just awesome. And, you know, anyway, I've gone back and watched this two more times, and I actually like this segment more each time I go back and watch it. All that feeling of feeling uncomfortable and not knowing what was going on is completely gone now when I go back and watch it. I think the reason a lot of people still hate it is for two reasons. A, they got trolled, and that's never a good feeling. And B, there's a certain sense of frustration when something happens and you either don't understand it or you can't explain it. It pisses you off. It gets under your skin. You know, it's the reason that so many movies these days are dumbed down, because film studios don't want the audience to think too hard, or they'll hurt their brains. What's so wrong with being forced to think about something? Or to go back and watch it a second or third time? I mean, some people aren't going to like this segment no matter what, you know, even if they understand that he's really a heel trolling the fans. And that's okay. You know, they want their instant gratification, and to them, it made for bad television. And to be honest with you, if you judge this show on its own, then yes, this was bad television. But I'm looking at the bigger picture here, and unless they swerve us all and go in a totally different direction, I can see where this is going, and the payoff is going to be enjoyable. And for all the people asking, you know, who is she? You know, those creepy videos made reference to a she. You know, is it Stephanie McMahon? I see people theorizing there could be some sort of relationship there between Jericho and Stephanie, because not just because they have a history together themselves, which wouldn't make sense because typically they always hated each other, but, you know, CM Punk, if it's going to be a feud with Punk and Jericho, Punk insulted Stephanie all those many months ago during his feud with Triple H, and so perhaps she had something to do with Jericho coming back. And I'm not going to sit here and say that there's absolutely no chance of that happening. My impression of it is that she is referring to the WWE Championship. She has summoned him for his return, that being a feud with Punk heading into WrestleMania. I mean, I could be wrong, but I tend to think that she is not referring to a person at all, but rather the title that is beckoning Chris Jericho. It's like guys that refer to their cars as a female. Isn't she a beauty? It makes sense that a wrestler would do the same thing for a title belt. So I actually really like this segment, and I find myself quite curious to see where it goes in the weeks ahead. So For all the people who wanted to know my thoughts on this, did I like it, did I hate it, this sucked, this was great. My first thought when I watched it, I didn't think it sucked, but I wasn't a fan of it at all. But upon watching it a second, third, and fourth time, I become a very big fan of that segment. That doesn't happen very often. You know, there were a lot of people who didn't like the fact that I trashed that Kane promo 2 weeks ago. How could you not like that segment? It was awesome. No, it wasn't. It sucked. And I went back a second time to watch it, not as a reviewer, but just as a fan, and I still thought it sucked. But not this one. I went back and watched it and had a newfound appreciation for Chris Jericho. I think this was great. Let's talk about the bad on this show. That was not a bad segment, if you look at the big picture. But there was a lot of bad on this show. I'm going to start playing a recording of myself when it comes to these John Cena promos and how horrendously aggravating they are. As usual, he started with comedy, because even when his back is against the wall, he can never take anything seriously. He made a bunch of stupid New Year's resolutions that weren't funny, including showing The Rock that he lost his lady parts, thus admitting that he does in fact have lady parts, so good job, John. Yet again, he pandered to the audience about how he's going to stay true to himself, and there's nothing greater than being in this ring and performing in front of the fans, and you can cheer and boo whoever you want, you're all great, blah, blah, blah. Why do we have to hear about crowd response on TV every week? Why do we have to hear about people talking about the reaction of the crowd? Why do I give a shit if this man is cheered or not? Why does Kane care so much about whether John Cena turns evil or stays a hero? Who cares? Why should we care about any of this? It is just beyond stupid. Just beyond stupid. Daniel Bryan beat Cody Rhodes with a small package on this show for the win. Yes, the World Heavyweight Champion had to beat the Intercontinental Champion with a small package and then celebrated like he had just won the Super Bowl. I hesitated actually putting this in the bad category only because it was obvious with Daniel Bryan's over-the-top celebrating after the match and the way he beat Big Show on SmackDown that he's going heel. If he isn't heel already, he's certainly going in that direction. So at least it plays into a storyline. And by the way, going back to that SmackDown match with Bryan and Big Show, I actually liked the ending of that match. It was a clever way to advance the heel turn, so I liked it. But anyway, still, the storyline here with Daniel Bryan is that he is an undeserving World Heavyweight Champion. So essentially, it's a reverse burial. They found a way to push this man right into his own grave. That creative team, how clever they are indeed. They should win some sort of award for this. Dolph Ziggler beat CM Punk by countout in their WWE Championship match, and I'm sorry to say, but I did not like this at all. I've seen both men have much better matches. At one point early on, Dolph went to drop Punk across the top rope for a stun gun, but fell a little bit short, and Punk's face collided with the middle rope. I was amazed he wasn't busted open. I believe Test actually once broke his nose when he struck the bottom rope while trying to slide into the ring. So those ropes can be very unforgiving. Thankfully, Punk was okay. He was a little bit shaken up backstage, but he was okay. Fast forward to the end of the match, Punk yanked the top turnbuckle pad off the rope in pretty blatant fashion, actually, which I don't believe was his intent. Johnny Ace came down to the ring to tell the referee to put the pad back on. And while this was going on, Punk had Ziggler in the Anaconda vice, and Dolph started tapping like a drunk man, as good old JR said during the Invasion pay-per-view back in 2001. The referee didn't see it, though, so Punk let go of the hold, and he looked like an idiot. I mean, really, you have the man at your mercy, locked in this brutal submission hold. He cannot escape. He's tapping out. Are you really so impatient that you can't wait another 5 or 10 seconds for the referee to turn around? I mean, come on. So Punk goes to confront Laryngitis, and Dolph charges him from behind. Punk moves, and he runs into our esteemed executive vice president. And Punk tries for the go to sleep. Ziggler wiggled his way out, pushed Punk towards the ropes, and Laryngitis pulled the top rope down. Was it on purpose, or was it by accident? That's for you to decide. And Punk goes crashing to the floor, and so bad was this fall that he could not return to the ring in time, and he was counted out. Now, mind you, the WWE title cannot change hands on a countout, as everybody knows. Not the challenger. Oh, no. Even Vicky Guerrero was telling the referee to count faster to make her the world's worst manager. I mean, would Bobby Heenan ever have done something as stupid as that? I think not. So Dolph wins, he grabs the title, he runs off celebrating with it like a complete fool. I mean, this was Lex Luger and Yokozuna from SummerSlam 93 all over again. Granted, that was worse, actually, because it was a pay-per-view main event built up for an entire summer. And Luger was the top babyface in the company, but still. This pretty well sucked and made no sense. Brodus Clay was apparently written into the script for Raw Monday night, squashing some local job guy, but he got pulled during the day due to time constraints. Probably just better off to save him for the Royal Rumble at this point. But this angle they're doing is just beyond lame. Just get him on television or not. Just enough already. I mean, like I said, save him for the Royal Rumble. Don't even hype him up as being on Raw anymore. Just save him for the Rumble. Have him come out as a surprise and just chuck five or six guys in a row. You know, he's pissed off. He's been screwed over now for weeks and weeks. Unleash the beast. Let him throw a couple of people out of the Rumble. He'll probably get a big babyface reaction for it. And just get this guy on TV already. Main event saw John Cena, Zack Ryder, and Big Show beat Mark Henry and Jack Swagger in a handicap match after Kane refused to participate. I wonder if my boss would be as cool with me not doing my job as John Laurinaitis seemingly was here with Kane refusing to do his. This was a nothing match. Henry and Show were pretty gone, were gone pretty quickly, I should say. I believe both guys were counted out. That left Swagger in there all alone with Cena and Ryder, and giving the babyfaces an awkward two-on-one advantage. Swagger put Ryder in the ankle lock, and I gotta say, I was shocked Ryder didn't tap out here. I thought for sure they'd have him tap. But instead, he made the hot tag to Cena, who did all of his signature moves. He beat Swagger just like that with the attitude adjustment. After the match, Kane's music hit, so Cena, being the dumb shit that he is, ran into the aisleway to try to cut him off, leaving an injured Zack Ryder alone in the ring to die. And he was favoring his ankle. Kane came up from underneath the ring. He went after Cena, and he once again smothered him into unconsciousness. And I wish he would do this during Cena's promos, not after his matches are over. You know? I mean, what an awesome gimmick that would be if whenever John Cena started cutting one of his cutesy, unfunny, pandering promos, if Kane just came up from under the ring and smothered him into silence. It would turn him face, I'm sure. So, at this point, Kane turned his attention to Zack Ryder in the ring. He tried to drag him back down into the hole with him. Oh yes, Kane wanted Zack Ryder in his hole. That is not a gimmick I would be in favor of, by the way. Ryder was scratching and clawing, trying as hard as he could not to be sucked down to Little People's Court in what looked like a scene from some really bad horror movie. Cena rushed into the ring to save Ryder and pulled him out of the hole. Cena was asking Ryder, "Are you okay?" Again, like something out of a movie. And then fire exploded from the hole in the ring, presumably burning Kane and all of the midgets who live under the ring alive. Kane's magical powers are hit or miss with me. You know, sometimes I like the effects they use, sometimes I don't. This was just dumb. I mean, you have a rare WWE Championship match on TV. You have the return of Chris Jericho for the first time in over a year. All on the same show, and this is what you save for the final segment. I know why they did it. They wanted Cena in the main event because Punk is poison to the ratings, apparently, but still. You know, I guess they were going for like a Hollywood-style cliffhanger to keep viewers interested, and you know, to them, they think that people are going to tune in next week, I guess, to see the next chapter in the John Cena-Kane feud, so I guess we'll find out if they're right. Talk about the ugly. There was a Divas tag match pitting the Bella Twins against Kelly Kelly and Eve Torres on this show. I have a question for you. How can such beautiful women be so ugly so often? I wish I had an answer for you, but they just always seem to be featured in the ugly column. Eve nailed a moonsault, and one of the twins broke up the pin attempt. Kelly distracted the referee, allowing for some twin magic, leading to the other Bella performing what may have been the worst cradle I have ever seen in my entire life. They botched a cradle. God bless these women. You know, going back to the Kane stuff for a second, I watched Raw is War from August 10th. 1998 on WWE Classics on Monday afternoon before I watched this show. And it was amazing to me to see Kane in the opening and closing segments of that show. And here we are this week, the first Raw of 2012, and we see Kane in the opening and the closing segments again. How many guys can say they've had that kind of staying power on WWE television over the years? I mean, the man has had an amazing run with that character. By the way, on that same Raw show from 1998, there was a Vince Russo special, we'll call it, where Val Venus, Apparently, he was in the ring with John Wayne Bobbitt a week after Val had presumably had his Valboski sliced off by Kai and Tai and Mr. Yamaguchi. I had absolutely no recollection of John Wayne Bobbitt appearing on Raw, but there he was, with Jerry Lawler poking fun at him and his misfortunes. For those younger listeners who have no idea who this man is, John Wayne Bobbitt became semi-famous when his wife cut off half his penis after he allegedly raped her, and then she drove off with it and threw the penis out the window and into a field. So, in fact, this would make him the second accused rapist to appear on WWE television that year. Not everything about the Attitude Era was so great, folks. Actually, I'm looking John Wayne Bobbitt up again here on Wikipedia, and it says that he went on to form a band called The Severed Parts, and he appeared in a porn flick called Frankenpenis. So there's your useless trivia for the day. By the way, if you do decide to go onto his Wikipedia page, there is a photo of the severed penis, so a little word of warning there. I did not realize what it was before I clicked on it, and just thought it looked like a piece of chicken. Apparently, it was not chicken. There was news on SEScoops.com earlier this week, citing a report from the Pro Wrestling Torch, that many TNA superstars have their contracts coming up this year, set to expire over the next several months, and there have been varying levels of interest from WWE as far as which talents they might want to pick up and which ones they did not have interest in. So there were a couple of names listed in the report on SC Scoops, so I figured I would go through it name by name. These are, again, TNA talents who have contracts that will be coming up very soon for expiration in the company. Perhaps the biggest name on the list, which I'm sure you've seen other reports on during the week, Rob Van Dam. And apparently there is a lot of interest on WWE's part, and RVD would be interested in going back, which kind of surprises me just because he has been, I don't want to say a vocal critic, but he has never been one to mince words. He's always had a good relationship with WWE. He had an appearance once at the Royal Rumble, and I think on the 15th anniversary Raw, they brought him back. Of course, once he signed with TNA, those appearances ended. But RVD always struck me and has made comments and interviews about his thoughts on weed, for example, which is banned by the WWE wellness policy. And not wanting to work a full-time schedule like he used to, and TNA certainly affords him an easier lifestyle than he had in WWE. Maybe not in terms of the money he makes, but in terms of having days off to spend with his wife. But apparently both sides are interested in once again getting back together. There's interest on both sides. As far as RVD coming back to WWE, yes, it would be a very big name. You know, from WWE's side, I could see where bringing back Rob Van Dam would be something that they're interested in. He still has a name. He's a former World Heavyweight Champion. God knows that WWE can use one or two more big names. You know, they're very lucky to have Chris Jericho back. Hopefully he'll be a positive as far as the Raw brand is concerned, bring some new life to the Raw brand, work with Punk and other younger guys. RVD could be that same guy maybe on SmackDown, not even necessarily on Raw. God knows SmackDown needs some names. They don't really have a whole lot of baby faces right now. I think, in fact, with Randy Orton out of action and Rey Mysterio still out, the Big Show may be the de facto big baby face along with Sheamus on the SmackDown brand. That's not good. So bringing guys like RVD back and putting him on SmackDown would actually make a lot of sense. But if you're asking me personally, do I want to see Rob Van Dam back in World Wrestling Entertainment? I have nothing against the guy personally. Rob Van Dam has done severe damage, in my opinion, to his value in the time that he has spent with TNA. And it's not all TNA's fault. Part of it also is people get older. You know, RVD now, if he's not 40, he's pretty close to it. He's not the same caliber athlete or talent he was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. Nobody would be. So he's gotten older. He's a little bit slower. But where I do blame TNA is that, you know, you signed this guy, you made a big deal about it, you put the championship on him. If you remember, Rob Van Dam never cleanly lost the title. And after being involved in main events and being the champion, RVD got slotted down a little bit further down the card, and he was in these meaningless mid-card feuds. Rob Van Dam, for all intents and purposes right now in TNA, is almost, I don't want to say, you know, he's not a job guy, obviously, but he's almost like a lower-level mid-card guy, which is amazing to me, because at one point, he was the man. So TNA has misused him, and that coupled with his age and the fact that he's slowing down and he really does nothing to impress me in the ring. He never seems motivated. rarely, if ever, does he seem to go out of his way to put on a really great match. And I can't blame him entirely, given his spot on the card and the fact that nobody even bothers buying TNA pay-per-views. So it's just, it hasn't been a good fit for him. It really hasn't. It's killed a lot of his value. RVD, him coming back, does not excite me like it might have a couple of years ago. When Rob Van Dam first came to WWE in 2001 from the original ECW, he was the one guy who came over from WCW or ECW that truly excited me. I mean, he was a guy at the time who was an innovator. He would go in the ring and he could fly around the ring and do moves and stuff that nobody else could do. I mean, his athleticism and his agility and all of that stuff just amazed me, the things he could do in that ring. And again, that was over 10 years ago. Father Time is a bitch, but TNA can be a bitch to a lot of people too. And to me, Rob Van Dam, you know, when I bring him in, like I said, you could use some name value on SmackDown, but to me, if WWE didn't have these injury problems, and if Randy Orton was still on the active roster, and Rey Mysterio didn't get hurt, and Sin Cara didn't get hurt, I don't quite frankly see there being much of a need to bring back RVD. I really don't. I think it would be a waste of money. I think it would be a lot of headaches, potentially, that he could cause. This potential signing, which probably will end up happening, does not excite me really at all, to be perfectly honest with you. James Storm and Bobby Roode, two long-standing TNA roster members, apparently have their contracts coming up soon enough. And as the story goes, WWE was interested in bringing them in as a tag team, not so much as singles wrestlers. So they may actually take a pass on bringing in Storm and Roode, unless they really, really want to come to WWE and they're willing to come in on the cheap. But, you know, I don't think they should sell themselves short. You know, you've got two very talented guys in James Storm and Bobby Roode who have proven their worth. If WWE doesn't want to bring them in, doesn't want to pay them what they're worth, is going to bring them in and just, you know, send them down to Florida, and they're going to flounder in Florida for a couple of years. If I'm them, I'm almost inclined to stay loyal to TNA. You know, TNA has their own issues. They have their good weeks and they have their bad weeks. But the one thing you got to say is that James Storm and Bobby Roode are homegrown TNA talents. And they now have either become the World Heavyweight Champion, or in the case of Bobby Roode, they are the World Heavyweight Champion. They are the top guy in the company. They have made it to that level. There was a lot of shit they had to go through. TNA pushed a lot of older, former WWE guys who probably didn't deserve to be pushed as hard as they were, pushed them ahead of younger guys. But eventually the cream rises to the top. You've got to push younger faces because people get sick and tired of seeing the same people over and over again. So they've gotten their shot. They've really delivered on it. I think Bobby Roode has done a good job. James Storm clearly is over with the audience. I think if you continue to build to an eventual rematch between the two of them, that'll do some pretty good business for them. But, you know, bringing them in as a tag team would have been awesome. I thought Beer Money was a great tag team. And the problem is that if they both agree to leave TNA and come to WWE, you could still put them together as a tag team if you want to, but obviously it would look bad. You know, you've got two guys who have been feuding over this championship in TNA. One guy, you know, turned on his best friend and bashed him over the head with a beer bottle, and they go on to feud for several months. All of a sudden, you bring him into WWE, and they're like best friends, and nothing ever happened. You could do that. You know, I could see WWE saying, you know, TNA storylines be damned. Most of our audience has never watched a single episode of Impact, so they probably won't know any better. Or you send him down to developmental for a year and then bring him back, and, you know, people have short memories. That's kind of what they did, actually, with the Bashams, I believe. When Doug and Danny Basham came up to WWE as a unit, I believe they had been feuding as singles in Ohio Valley Wrestling. And they just decided to bring them up as a tag team and pretend like none of that stuff ever happened, which kind of made Jim Cornette look stupid because, you know, I think he was the one still booking down at OVW at the time, and he probably wasn't very happy about that. But, you know, it's up to WWE. They could do whatever they want to. If they really want Storm and Roode bad enough and they want to put them together as a team, they could bring them in as a tag team. If they don't want them, I think it's a mistake on WWE's part. I think either guy would be a fine addition to the roster. James Storm in particular, I think, would be something of a better fit for WWE just because he's got that charisma. You know, I was not very happy with the way TNA screwed over Bobby Roode. If you go back to that match on pay-per-view with Kurt Angle, ultimately he did get the championship. He turned heel, so, you know, all's well that ends well. I still disagree with the way TNA went about doing it. But James Storm, if you're talking about people going to WWE, I think they'd like him better just because he's got the personality. He's very good on promos. His work is fine, too, but he's got that extra something in terms of his charisma that Bobby Roode doesn't necessarily have. I could see James Storm, even with the accent, and I know WWE tends to frown on people who have that southern accent, but he could do very well for himself, I think, there. And Bobby Roode probably could go over and do well enough as well, but I think James Storm, the potential is there for him to really be a bigger star. And if I'm WWE, just because I can't get both of them as a tag team, I don't decide to pass on the guy. I just think that it would be very foolish on their part if that's what they end up doing. Now, speaking of foolish, apparently WWE has little or no interest at all in Samoa Joe. And that is in spite of Steve Austin's very strong endorsement of him on Twitter last year. And obviously, Joe is friends with a lot of people on the WWE roster, people like Daniel Bryan and CM Punk, who, by the way, he had tremendous matches with back in the day in Ring of Honor. Nobody will ever discount Joe's ability as a worker. But WWE basically doesn't want him, and they probably don't want him for all the reasons that you would figure. He's a guy that does not look like a professional wrestler should if you are Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon probably looks at Samoa Joe and goes, "This guy's a wrestler." You know, he probably looks at Joe and says, "I don't get it." And a lot of people probably look at Joe and say, "I don't get it." Even some people listening to the show, not everybody is a Samoa Joe fan. Not everybody saw him work in Ring of Honor. Not everybody saw his 21-month reign, I believe it was, as Ring of Honor champion. But the thing is, you know, again, Joe is somebody who has done himself no favors by staying with TNA. Samoa Joe's contract came up a couple of years ago. And it was already very obvious by that point that TNA didn't know how to use him. They used him initially very well. And the stuff with Kurt Angle, and he won the championship, and Joe was doing well in TNA. And then he hit a wall. And Joe's contract came up, and instead of splitting, even to go back to Ring of Honor, to test the waters in WWE, he decided to stay with TNA. Now, maybe he did test the waters with WWE, maybe he did. And WWE probably said, "We're not interested." So he said, "Okay, I'll stay with TNA." But by re-signing with TNA, name me one positive benefit that Joe has gotten since he re-signed a couple of years ago with TNA. When he actually does appear on television, does he ever do anything of any note? Is anybody actually excited or intimidated by the Samoa Joe character anymore? Imagine the transformations this guy has gone through. That stupid tattoo he had on his face, wielding a sword. Remember when he got kidnapped? I talked about that on the show. I joked about it. He was kidnapped. And I'm not even sure that storyline ever had a resolution. The man was kidnapped, and apparently they took all of his enthusiasm with them because the guy just doesn't seem motivated. He's kind of like Rob Van Dam. It's hard to get motivated when you're not being used to your full potential. It just kills you. It's like what WWE does sometimes with some of these young guys. They beat the enthusiasm right out of them. So they're not excited. They just show up to work. They do their job. They get a paycheck, and they go home. And Joe is always a guy, and probably still is. He takes a lot of pride in his work. You listen to Samoa Joe do interviews and such, and he, you know, raves about TNA and being part of the TNA organization and this and that. And maybe he's happy on some level. I'm sure Joe is making more money in TNA than he was at Ring of Honor. But as far as WWE is concerned, it bothers me just because Joe can be a very big star in WWE. He can be as big of a star as they want him to be. That's what they need more of. They need more stars. They made a real star this year in CM Punk. They can make a real star out of Samoa Joe. Samoa Joe can be very big. I don't just mean in the gut. I mean he can actually be a very big star in that company. Should he lose some weight? Probably, yeah. He probably should lose some weight. He's even bigger now than he was when he first came in. It probably would benefit him to do that. If nothing else, you know, certainly in terms of the eyes of the people who watch from WWE, they probably would look at him right now and go, you know what, he's out of shape. We're not interested in bringing somebody like that into our organization. Maybe if he lost 15 or 20 pounds, it would help his cause. I don't know. I can't really say whether or not the weight gain has impacted or hurt his in-ring work because I just haven't seen him work very often lately. I can't remember the last Samoa Joe match I saw. But as somebody that has actually seen Samoa Joe work in person, live, numerous times, pre-TNA, this guy is money. And I can understand WWE not seeing that because he's been treated like shit now for far too long by TNA. But you can rehabilitate somebody. It's not impossible. Joe is not a lost cause. Out of everybody whose contracts are supposedly coming up for expiration this year in TNA, Joe is the one guy who, if I'm WWE, I do everything to go after him and bring him in. He can cut a great promo. He can work a great match. He can work multiple styles. He's worked with some people who are on the WWE roster. You don't need to throw him in developmental for 6 months or a year. He could come right to the main roster, just like Sin Cara did. It's not like they haven't done that with other guys before. Tyler Black has floundered in Florida now for at least the last 2 or 3 years. Joe doesn't even have to go down there. You can put him right on the main roster. It's not as though he needs to know how to work. He can adapt to whatever style you want him to. He may not look the part, but I think the more that people get used to seeing him, the more they hear him speak, people would become very big fans of Samoa Joe. He could do big things in WWE. If there was anybody on that TNA roster whose contract was coming up that I would steal away from them, it's not Rob Van Dam. RVD's best days are behind him. It's Samoa Joe. Matt Morgan is another guy whose contract supposedly is coming due. A lot of people seem to think Matt Morgan is going to make that leap back to WWE from TNA. You know, Matt Morgan is a guy who is right up WWE's alley. He's got size. He's got the look. Why they let him go in the first place, I'll never understand. You know, they had him doing that stupid stuttering gimmick, and then they got rid of him. Which, again, I never got because he always had the size. You know, they're so obsessed with size, especially back when Matt Morgan was last in the company a couple of years ago. It shocked me, quite frankly, that they just let him slip through their fingers and go to TNA. Now he's been cutting his teeth in TNA. He's been trying to get better. I wouldn't look at Matt Morgan now and say, oh, what a great wrestler. I'm sure he's probably better now than he was back then, which is a plus. He's probably more comfortable cutting promos and such. But who's to say that he doesn't go back to WWE and they stick him right back in that stupid stuttering gimmick again? You know, that would be my concern if I'm him. But I could also see his point of view. He wants to go back to the big leagues. He wants to make better money. He's got the look. He's, you know, he's not getting any younger. I'd say take a chance on Matt Morgan. You know what? Matt Morgan, let me say this. Matt Morgan, to me, is a prime candidate for a mask gimmick. I'm not saying he looks bad or he's ugly or anything like that, but I'm a fan of gimmicks like that. We don't see enough of that in wrestling. I know we have, you know, Sin Cara wears a mask, and now Kane has his mask back. We need more masked wrestlers. And Matt Morgan is a monster. I mean, you look at the guy, he's big. I don't know what he is. He's 6'5" or whatever the hell he is. He's a big boy. Bring him in with some sort of gimmick where he wears a mask. I think that might actually work for him. Because Matt Morgan alone, Matt Morgan by himself, is boring. Matt Morgan is fucking boring. No offense to him personally, but he is. So maybe putting a mask on him, giving him, kind of a cool ring name, might be a good gimmick. You bring him over, he's already got the size, he can go around beating the hell out of people. You may have a new star on your hands. That might be one idea for Matt Morgan. If I'm WWE and going to bring him over, I would certainly give some thought to doing something like that with him. Bully Ray is another name mentioned. WWE apparently is interested in having him back. No word on whether or not they would want to bring D-Von in. Bully Ray is doing some of the best work of his career right now as a single star. And he is surprising a lot of people, myself included. I mean, a lot of people knew the kind of promos he could cut. Back in the old ECW, you couldn't really do that in WWF, especially not now, in the PG era, which is my concern. You know, you bring the Bully Ray character over, not that he's going on television every week cussing up a storm, but it's almost that the Bully Ray character is not conducive to a PG WWE, but it almost works perfectly because they have the anti-bullying campaign. So now you bring a character in called Bully Ray, although they may not be able to call him Bully Ray. In a way, it would kind of work. Here's this heel bully. It would only work if you have put him up against a babyface who beats him. Bully Ray is, he's almost like an enigma. I mean, here's a guy who is best known for being part of a tag team, the Dudley Boys, one of the better tag teams in wrestling of the last 20 years, at least in terms of the success they've had. There's been far, far, far better tag teams, as workers. But here's a guy who got old, went to TNA with D-Von. The reason he left WWE, and I was actually happy to see the Dudleys leave WWE, because they were beyond stale. And within a few years of being in TNA, the Dudleys were stale there too. So it became an issue of, what do you do with these guys? These guys are not ready to retire. They're not ready to call it quits. They feel they have something to contribute. For the longest time, they didn't want to be split up because WWE split them up, and then it failed, and they had to put them back together. But they were so beyond stale, it was just incredible. What do you do with them? So they split him up. Bubba Ray became a heel, and he just took the ball and just ran with it. He's also lost a lot of weight in recent years. He's gotten himself into the best shape physically maybe of his entire career. So at the age of, I think, 40, he might actually be 40 or 41 years old. This guy's doing some of the best work of his entire life, but he's not getting any younger. So if I'm WWE, I sign this guy, And don't waste any time. I think Bully Ray would be a great addition to the WWE roster. Just a great addition. D-Von, I'm a little more iffy on. Just because, no offense to D-Von, again, personally, but he doesn't really do much for me. You know, D-Von's a great worker, but he's not anything overly special. And I would not bring the Dudleys back as a tag team. I just think as much as WWE could use tag teams, and I'm going to get to that in a second, the Dudleys, there's something about them that still rings stale. And I think the Bully Ray character could actually mean more money for WWE if they play their cards right. The Pope, D'Angelo De Niro, apparently his contract is coming up as well. WWE was said to have an interest last year when he was being pushed, not so much anymore. It's funny how that works. When TNA pushes a guy, WWE has interest, and when they don't, they, like Samoa Joe, they could care less. The Pope is somebody I would bring in. I think the Pope has something to contribute. That was a ball that was dropped by WWE a long time ago. When they had Elijah Burke under contract and he was part of the ECW brand, he could have been a lot bigger than he was. And they let him go, and TNA signed him, and they gave him the Pope gimmick, and he just took off from there. Again, until TNA dropped the ball on him as well and started really not doing much with him at all. People stopped caring. It's funny how that works. But the Pope is somebody that has that charisma they like. You know, he can cut a promo. He can be a very... very pompous, kind of outgoing type of guy. He could be a heel, he could be a face. He's more suited, I think, to be a heel, but the kind of heel that I think people would start cheering after a while. So I would take a chance on the guy and bring him in. You know, I don't know how old he is. He might be in his 30s. I would imagine he probably is actually in his early 30s, but he's not an old guy. He's still a somewhat young guy you could bring in, I think, and he could be a fine addition to the mid-card. I don't see him being a world champion or anything like that, but he could be a fine challenger to the Intercontinental title or the U.S. title on either brand. I think that would work. Last names here that were mentioned in the report, Ink Inc., the team of Shannon Moore and Jesse Neal. Jesse Neal is already gone from TNA. They have officially given him a release from his contract, so he is officially a free agent, I believe, as of the 1st of January. He is no longer under contract, and he's done interviews recently where Jesse Neal has talked about how he would love to be in WWE. His dream, his WrestleMania, would be competing on one of the Tribute to the Troops shows because, of course, he's a former Navy man, and he served his country. And you know, WWE, I think, tends to like people like that. That could actually work to his advantage. Jesse Neal is still kind of a green guy, very young. He's being trained by the Dudleys, or at least the Bully Ray, down in Florida. He's definitely improved from the first few Jesse Neal matches I saw in TNA. The last couple of ones I saw, he was actually pretty good. And he's got a good look to him, certainly with the mohawk. It's a unique look. Shannon Moore is somebody that I just don't care about. I really don't. You know, he's part of that whole Carolina cocaine crew. I've talked about them so many goddamn times. I'm sick of it already. Shannon Moore is a talented guy. I'm not denying that. But Shannon Moore, who cares? You know, there's a million Shannon Moores out there. There's nothing about Shannon Moore to me except his hairdo that stands out. And Shannon Moore had a nice run for a couple of years with WWE, and he ran his course, and they let him go. If I'm WWE, I am not rushing to sign Shannon Moore. Shannon Moore is not going to be a game changer for that company. And if they're in need of better workers, just to kind of put on the roster to put other guys over, you've got some pretty good workers already down in Florida who are just begging to come on to television. You don't need Shannon Moore. Jesse Neal? Well, Jesse Neal's a guy that if I'm going to sign him, I'd probably sign him, and he probably does need to go down to developmental. But again, either guy. I mean, I'm not interested in seeing them on television right now. I'm just not. WWE might have had an interest in them, I should say, as a tag team. I don't know if the fact that Shannon Moore is still with TNA and Jesse Neal is not impacts that at all. But, you know, the one thing about that is, yes, I would like to see more tag teams in WWE. If WWE wants to bring in Ink Inc. collectively as a tag team, I'm okay with that. Shannon Moore coming back with Jesse Neal as a tag team to add to the division, I'm fine. I'm fine with that. I want more tag teams. Otherwise, I see absolutely no need to have either one, especially Shannon Moore on the roster. I just don't see it. I just don't see it as being a worthwhile investment. There's a million Shannon Moores out there. There's nothing about him except his hairstyle that jumps out at me and screams, wow, sign this guy, he's so great. You know, he had his run, he left, and that's it. You know, what's that book he walks around with, the book of Dilly Gaff? Is that what it is? Well, I'll take a page out of the book of Dilly Gaff. People ask me, oh, does WWE sign Shannon Moore? I say, do I look like I give a fuck? The answer to that question, no. WWE Champion CM Punk is going to be appearing on Fox later this month, but not for WWE. Apparently, the Punker will corner Chael Sonnen on January 28th in Chicago, Punk's hometown, at the UFC on Fox show coming up. Chael Sonnen and Mark Munoz will be fighting on that particular show. Apparently, it was an invitation from Chael Sonnen that CM Punk accepted. And Vince McMahon gave him the night off because WWE, I believe, has a house show that night. I believe that's actually the night before the Royal Rumble. So I don't know if WWE can get any publicity out of that, if they can plug it somehow. But Punk will be escorting him down to the cage. He will not be staying in his corner in the cage. I don't know what advice he would possibly have to offer Chael Sonnen, but he will be walking to the cage with him and will probably get some TV time on Fox. So that's coming up on the 28th. Rowdy Roddy Piper supposedly confirmed as the first legend on the WWE Legends House show for their new network. He has signed on for the show. It begins filming in Florida later this month. And they need to get Kevin Nash and the Ultimate Warrior in that house. That's what I would like to see. And when I first saw all the headlines last week that said Kevin Nash shoots on the Warrior, I honest to God thought it said Kevin Nash shoots the Warrior. Which probably would have been a far more preferable outcome, so that we wouldn't be treated to these really pathetic back-and-forth promos, which I'm not even going to dignify with an opinion on, because I just don't care. It's a couple of old guys arguing over nothing for a fight that will never happen. We've reached the part of the show where I turn things over to you guys. It's time for the mailbag here on the bicentennial edition of The Sound Off. As always, you can email me your questions directly to thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can send me messages on Facebook, a lot of you do, but if you want questions for the mailbag to get a direct answer, you've got to email me. It's got to be thesolomonster@gmail.com, and I got a lot of emails from you guys over the last 2 weeks. I am severely backlogged here. I'm going to try to get to as many of the questions and shout-outs here as I can. We'll start with John from Northern Ireland, who has been one of our loyal listeners since December of 2007, the month after the Sound Off debuted. He says, "Dear Solomonster, I wanted to congratulate you on reaching 200 episodes on Podcast 100. I wished you well for 100 more. He wants to know if we could reach 300 shows. Well, I certainly hope so. That's the plan at this point. He says, as WWE's audience is shrinking, yours is increasing. I'm glad to have been a part of it since Episode 5. I'd love to get a shout-out on 200 since I have on most of the big shows over the last couple of years. Once again, congratulations and keep up the awesome work." Well, thank you. And there's your shout-out right there, John from Northern Ireland, one of our loyal listeners, who, by the way, I think also his voice is part of our outro, if I remember correctly. He can be heard there. So a big thanks to him for his support. Vic from Vegas writes in to the Sound Off here. "Solomonster, I saw a video of an old George the Animal Steel match, which today would not be seen because it is very disturbing. It was a match against Rick Bolton. It was rumored that Bolton could separate his shoulder at any time. Do you think it would be possible for us to see this match in today's WWE? How gruesome was this match?" And I'll be honest with you, I had heard about this match before, and until I got Vic's email here, I had never actually seen it. And I managed to find the match. It wasn't actually on YouTube. You can do a Google search for George Steele and Rick Bolton, and there's a link that comes up here from the website strengthfighter.com. And they actually have great, it's not the best video quality, but there is grainy video of this match. The video is about 5 minutes long. It was a match from looks like a WWF show from the late 70s. And this thing is every bit as gruesome as Vic says it is. I had never seen this before. But at one point during the match, George basically dislocates this guy's arm. And the arm is this clearly dislocated and twisted in just an absolutely gruesome way. And he throws the guy out of the ring onto the hardwood floor. He follows him to the outside. He continues to attack the arm and stomp on the arm. I mean, the arm is just twisted and mangled. And apparently this guy could pop his arm out on command. The thing about that is that even the people who can actually do that, it's kind of like Mel Gibson's character in the first Lethal Weapon movie, really the entire Lethal Weapon series. He had that thing where he could, if he wanted to, he could kind of dislocate his arm or his shoulder. It's kind of the same thing. Some people can do that. Some people are freaks. But it's still a very painful thing to do. And for this guy to pop his arm out like that and then have George Deal continue to pound on it and stomp on it, I mean, I just sat here wincing the entire time. This is one of the most disturbing things I think I've ever seen from WWF television. And I had never seen it before. So if you want to see the video, I would just give you a word of warning. But you can go online and find it, Google it. Go to the if you find the link at the strengthfighter.com website, you may have to just Google it. Because the video of the Rick Bolton match is not on YouTube. What is on YouTube, though, is another match with George Steele from the WWF in 1984, where a similar thing occurred with another jobber by the name of Brian Madden. And this is actually on YouTube. And this video also is very disturbing because the guy's arm comes out at one point and the animal continues to attack him. And it's just very gruesome, very uncomfortable stuff. Again, I had never seen this before. I had heard rumors of the Rick Bolton match. I didn't even know that this happened a second time with another jobber. Really, really, really sick stuff. But what it illustrated to me was something that I don't think a lot of people think about. This is a form of professional wrestling that we will never, ever in our lifetime see again. And it's not that I want people to go on TV and to dislocate people's arms, because that's disgusting. But it's that form of wrestling where you actually take a guy, in this case George Steele, who before he became the bumbling babyface was actually a killer heel. You take a guy who you want to get over, you want to portray him and build him up as a monster. And they found a way to do that. I mean, they happen to have these guys who, you know, could dislocate their arms, so it kind of played into the story. And it worked to the company's benefit. But they went out of their way to make this guy look like a killer, and it succeeded. Because there's no way anybody could watch this and not have a feeling that, wow, this is sick. This guy is deranged. I don't want to get in the ring with this guy. This is the second guy now whose arm he's completely destroyed. And George Steele was an absolute monster. A monster of a man. You can't watch this and not help but feel sorry for the other guy and think this guy is just, he's sick. He's sick in the head. And, you know, that level of believability and realism, I think, is completely absent from pro wrestling these days. And it's so far gone and so far removed from the way things are done today that we're never, ever going to see this again. Not on a national scale in a WWE or a TNA. You'll never see this kind of pro wrestling and this kind of character, I think, on television ever again. The best you'll get is a guy like Brodus Clay, who they want to build up as a monster. And you know, their explanation of how to, you know, do an angle is to just pretend the guy's going to debut every week on TV and just keep pushing it back, I guess, because it's funny. You know, that's what we get in 2012. But my God, you've got to see these George Steele matches if your stomach can handle it. It is just sick, sick stuff. But I would encourage people who do want to watch it, go ahead and watch it. It really is something quite amazing if you've never seen it before. Matthew from Belfast, Northern Ireland, another Northern Ireland listener, writes in, what is the worst finish to a match that you've ever seen? Well, after that cradle on Raw Monday night, I might say the Bella Twins against Kelly and Eve. You know, Montreal, the match between Bret and Shawn at Survivor Series, even though the long-term impact was probably a big plus for the WWE in terms of the business that it ended up generating as a match, I thought that was just a god-awful finish because it was so obvious that Bret didn't actually submit. And to go off the air early that way on your big pay-per-view and change your championship that way with a fake finish was just so stupid. Probably the worst finish I could think of off the top of my head. I could probably just take time to put a whole list together. But in terms of the major promotions, in terms of TV matches, in terms of big matches, you know, WCW promoted a very big main event on their television program for the World Heavyweight Championship between Hulk Hogan and Kevin Nash, two of its biggest stars. This was the big main event of a show that, if I remember correctly, that show was taking place, I don't know if it was the Georgia Dome, but it was a very, very big crowd they had in the arena that night. Tens of thousands of people in that building. And it was the main event of the show, and this was the infamous Finger Poke of Doom, which I believe was January 4th, 1999. If I remember correctly, which would actually, we just passed the anniversary of that match. It was the Finger Poke of Doom, one of the many events people point to as the beginning of the end for WCW. It was certainly not the beginning of the end by itself. It helped speed things up. It was one of the many reasons. It wasn't a meaningless random match. If you want to do a fuck finish like that, even that would suck, but you could say, okay, fine, it's a nothing match. Who cares if we have a finger poke for a finish? This was the main event of the show for your championship that you promoted the entire night, and two of the biggest stars in your company in front of a huge audience, not just on television, but in the arena that night. The main event. And you have one guy poke the other guy in the chest. He lays on top of him. He pins him. And they make a mockery. An absolute mockery of your title. An absolute mockery of the fans. A mockery of the product. Just a mockery all around. And you wonder why that company is no longer in business. That's one of the reasons. I can't think of a worse finish that did more damage to a company than the finger poke of doom back in 99. Nissim writes in, he is not a fan of Zack Ryder. He says it was ridiculous seeing Zack Ryder taking the same credit as CM Punk and Daniel Bryan were on Raw a couple of weeks ago. He's a nice guy, but wrestling-wise, he has little to offer, and I do not believe he went through the same difficult roads those two went through. WWE is using him, not that he should complain, due to his fan base. Once and if he loses his momentum, he will disappear like the Patriot. Will he be around in a couple of years? In your opinion, what does your gut tell you? My gut tells me that in a couple of years, Zack Ryder is going to be either just another guy on the roster, or more likely, he won't even be on the WWE roster. And it's not because I don't like Zack Ryder. I like him. I respect him for what he's been able to accomplish. And I think as a United States champion, he could do well for himself. He's not world championship material, not with this gimmick. And he got over because of the fans, in spite of what people in the company wanted. He got over anyway. But I think in a couple of years, he's going to be forgotten. I don't think you're looking at a guy who's going to have too much in the way of staying power. If we're talking 4 or 5 years down the road, then Zack Ryder will be a relic. Certainly not being pushed like he is today. Matt writes in, am I the only person who wants The Undertaker to face a new opponent at WrestleMania? I did not want to see Undertaker Triple H last year, and I don't want to see it this year. If you had to choose someone new to face The Undertaker this year at WrestleMania, who would it be? I would go with either Sheamus or Wade Barrett. I had other people ask me this question and suggest Wade Barrett. No offense to Wade Barrett. I think he's a fine worker. Him and Undertaker could probably have a good match. Undertaker needs more than just a good match at WrestleMania. It's not even just him getting in the ring with a good worker. He needs to get in the ring with somebody that, you know, standing across the ring, there's some sort of aura that they bring to that match. John Cena is by no means a very good worker. But the John Cena dynamic of having him in the ring with The Undertaker at WrestleMania and people honestly believing, holy shit, they're going to put this guy over The Undertaker and end the streak would be awesome, even though I don't believe they would do that. But obviously John Cena is a little bit tied up this year, so who do you put in the ring with The Undertaker? Of the two names you mentioned, I don't like Wade Barrett as an opponent for The Undertaker. Sheamus, I could see. And Sheamus, of the two, I would go with Sheamus. I think babyface versus babyface actually works better in this case than babyface versus heel. And Sheamus is a guy who fans are behind. They're trying to push him as something special. It's not as obvious to me. I just feel like if you put Wade Barrett in there with The Undertaker, obviously Undertaker's going to beat him. Like, there's absolutely nobody in the world who would believe that Wade Barrett was going to beat The Undertaker. If you put him in the ring with Cena, I think there's that doubt. If you put him in the ring with Orton, I think there's that doubt. If you put him in the ring with Sheamus, you know, some people may also say there's no doubt, but not necessarily. You know, maybe they would put Sheamus over The Undertaker, even though you and I both know they wouldn't do that. But some people could believe that. They could talk themselves into believing that this is a company who is pushing Sheamus as one of the new top guys on SmackDown. What better way to get this guy over than by having him beat The Undertaker at WrestleMania? You could get people, I think, to buy into that as a possibility. With Wade Barrett, there is absolutely nobody on the face of this earth, I cannot imagine, who would even give Wade Barrett an ounce of an edge over The Undertaker and think he might actually win. So of the two, I would go with Sheamus. I try to think of other guys in the current roster because I also am not enamored by putting Triple H back in the ring with him. And again, Triple H is not ending the streak. Who do you go with? It's hard. It really is. You look up and down that roster, and aside from Cena and maybe Orton, I don't see anybody that really excites me. Sheamus may well be my number three. So, you know, Undertaker and Sheamus, I wouldn't mind that match. In fact, Undertaker and Sheamus, I might actually like that match more than Undertaker versus Triple H. And probably better than Mark Henry as well, for the people who have suggested Mark Henry, because Henry has already been beaten. You know, they had Daniel Bryan get the visual pin on him several weeks ago. They had Mark Henry lose clean to a knockout punch by the Big Show. So whatever allure a Mark Henry Undertaker match might have had, the bloom is already off the rose. I don't look at Mark Henry and say, wow, I would love to see Mark Henry and the Undertaker. God bless Mark Henry. I said earlier, the guy's my new hero. But that's also a match we've seen before at WrestleMania, and quite frankly, it wasn't very good. And Undertaker and his knees and his body were in better shape in 2006 at WrestleMania when they had a match than they're going to be in 2012. So Sheamus might actually be my choice. Mike from Jeffersonville, Kentucky writes in, back some time ago, the Million Dollar Man had a fake Undertaker. Him and the real Undertaker had a match at SummerSlam. Who was the fake Undertaker and whatever happened to him? The fake Undertaker was Brian Lee, who was actually in the original ECW. He was in WWE as well, later on as Chains from the Disciples of Apocalypse faction, and was good friends with the Undertaker behind the scenes. So he portrayed the fake Undertaker back in 94. As far as what happened to him, I honestly don't know. I don't know if he's still competing independently. I haven't heard. So I don't know what he's up to these days, but that is who he was. Jacob writes in, why does WWE cut out the Cobra Commander and Pepsi symbols on CM Punk's arms in the video games? Because those are copyrighted logos that are not owned by WWE. So therefore, they cannot appear on CM Punk action figures, for example, and they cannot appear in the video game as well. Otherwise, Pepsi, for example, would probably take umbrage to that. Alex in Chicago writes in. He wants to know about the possibility we see gimmick pay-per-views like Hell in a Cell, Money in the Bank, and TLC fall to the wayside with this new network. Highly unlikely. In fact, the WWE's already set their pay-per-view schedule, and I don't know about the tail end of the year, but a lot of these shows are supposedly going to be coming back, and I don't think we're going to be rid of them anytime soon. The second part of his question here, what are the chances we see Money in the Bank back at WrestleMania in the near future? I feel Money in the Bank consistently made WrestleMania a lot stronger and never failed to disappoint. Money in the Bank at WrestleMania pretty much all the time was always a very good to great match. But again, you've had two Money in the Bank pay-per-views so far, both of which have been excellent, excellent shows. And as far as I know, Money in the Bank is on the docket for 2012. It is coming back. If you're going to have a Money in the Bank pay-per-view in the summer, it makes no sense to have a Money in the Bank match at WrestleMania. So I don't think we're going to see Money in the Bank at WrestleMania this year. Could it be next year? Possibly. But I think you've got to get rid of the pay-per-view first. If you're going to keep the pay-per-view, I would not put Money in the Bank on WrestleMania. You don't need three Money in the Bank matches every year. You don't even need two Money in the Bank matches every year. I think even two is overkill. You don't need one for each title. If you're going to do it, just have one. Either do one in the main event of the pay-per-view, or get rid of the entire pay-per-view and bring Money in the Bank back to WrestleMania, which frankly is an idea that I would be in support of. It was a great way to get six or eight guys who don't have any real direction at the time onto the pay-per-view doing something meaningful. They're fighting for a title shot. It's giving them something to fight for. And more often than not, yeah, I mean, it's a dangerous match. Guys are put in danger. They're doing all these crazy spots. They're trying to top themselves. But it usually is an excellent match, and it would keep us limited to one person per year with the briefcase, which the more people you have running around with a briefcase, the more marginalized your titles become. Just look at Daniel Bryan. I mean, the guy won the Money in the Bank briefcase. It was a feel-good moment, and they went on to job him out for the next 4 months. Now he's the champion, and you have Michael Cole on television every week talking about how he doesn't deserve to be the champion. He backdoored his way into the championship, and the reason it sucks is because it's true. So, again, you don't need more than one briefcase. You certainly don't need three. I'd be perfectly content with bringing Money in the Bank back to WrestleMania, but apparently that's not in the plans right now. Adam writes in, this email actually came in about a week and a half ago or so. He says, Dear Solomonster, I'm part of your Fantastic Four. My birthday is December 31st. Was wondering if I could get a shootout. Well, I don't want to have a shootout with you. I'll give you a shout-out. I don't want to get in a shootout. His question is, you mentioned about Daniel Bryan winning the briefcase, then going on a losing streak. Ironically, I just mentioned that now. Why is it that WWE does this? Why do they put the wrestler on a losing streak if they win something? Because they're fucking stupid. That's the short answer. Trust writes into the Sound Off here, Dear Solomonster. Why did WWE find it necessary to change Jack Swagger's character after he left ECW? I felt that the cocky, arrogant, all-American character fit Jack better than this half-price, sulking Jericho, which he's just not good at. What is your take on that? Would he have been better if creative had not tampered with him? I can sit here for hours if you want me to list all the people that would have been better off without creative tampering with them. The reason that you feel that way is because the character fits Jack Swagger a lot better. It's a lot truer to his true self. if you watch the, he's doing videos now on YouTube. He's answering listener questions and stuff from like Twitter and YouTube and such. And he pretty much stays in character, I think, for the most part during these videos. But he's very good at being cocky and arrogant and just a prick. Why? Because that's an extension of himself. I'm not saying he's a prick in real life. Maybe he is. I've never met him. But that character fits him. That's why it works better. And you'll notice when they have somebody doing something that doesn't fit their personality, they usually suck at it, unless they're that talented. And God bless Jack Swagger. He's a great wrestler. But it's not as though he's this great entertainer. In fact, I'm glad you mentioned Jack Swagger, because I have a pet peeve about this guy. I would complain a lot about John Morrison and how he sucked at promos and everything. Jack Swagger is also no good at promos, but what really gets on my nerves, if you'll notice this, and maybe now you will in the future when you watch the guy, when he's backstage during a skit, whether he's being interviewed or if the camera is just eavesdropping on a conversation that he's having with somebody, he looks so unnatural and uncomfortable talking and speaking in that role. It's noticeable. It is very noticeable. Usually he's looking not even at the person he's interacting with, which is not something he's the only one who's guilty of, but he does this all the time. He doesn't make eye contact with the person. He always looks, he sounds like he's reciting something. It's like, this guy sucks. Why do you keep putting him in this situation where he has to cut these backstage promos if he sucks at it? That's another thing that WWE does that pisses me off. They choose to, instead of hiding people's weaknesses and flaws, if they're not very good at promos, give them a manager. Well, guess what? Jack Swagger has a manager. Why is Vicky Guerrero not doing the speaking for him? What is the point of even having Vicky Guerrero as a manager if she's not going to do the speaking for the person that she's representing? So she goes down to the ring so she can get heat, which will hopefully rub off on the person that she's managing. And maybe she'll interfere every now and then and get kicked away from ringside. But there's so much more you could be doing with her. There's people like Jack Swagger who need that extra help, and they don't do these guys any favors by putting them in these segments and making them look like shit. And it's something I've noticed lately with Swagger that's really noticeable and really pisses me off. He's just so unnatural when he's speaking in these backstage segments. Watch the next segment he's in and tell me if you notice the same thing. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm picking on the guy, but I don't know. It just gets on my nerves. Curtis from Chicago writes in, Happy New Year, Solo Monster. Forget the 1,000th Raw coming up later this year. We are on the cusp of the 200th Sound-Off. And your question is actually on the 200th Sound-Off, so congratulations to you. The recent relationship hookups of Stacey Keibler with George Clooney and Tori Wilson with A-Rod, is the women's division now just a breeding ground for future girlfriends for powerful actors and athletes? I didn't know Vince McMahon was in the old-fashioned business of grooming females to be high-profile men's future girlfriends. Maybe the women's division is useful for something. I'll tell you what it's useful for. If Vince McMahon could parlay his supposed booking and promoting genius into making this a tag team match at WrestleMania, now that would be something right there. If he could get in touch with Stacy or Tori and see if they could somehow convince the women to talk George Clooney and A-Rod into participating in a tag match, A-Rod and Tori against Stacy and George at WrestleMania. You want publicity? You'll get publicity that way. That right there. Forget Shaq and Big Show. That's the match that you want to try to book if you're Vince McMahon. Alex from Tijuana, Mexico writes in, just got done listening to podcast 199. Great insight as always. As you know, I was lucky to be featured on podcast 50, 100, and 150, among others. So here is my shot to keep the streak alive for 200. What are the top three best and worst questions and comments you have received during this 200 episodes of The Sound Off, and how do you classify the questions by great, good, bad, or ugly? Thank you as always. Sigue con el grandioso trabajo. That comes from Alex in Tijuana, Mexico. You know what? I've gotten a lot of questions and comments and emails from people over the years, far too many to reflect back and remember all the good ones and all the bad ones. I've gotten some really, really, mostly good ones, and I've gotten some really bad ones as well. The one that kind of jumps out at me as far as being bad, I actually made reference to this about a week or two ago. I got an email from this idiot once who somehow tried to convince himself, I guess, that Randy Savage was not a legend. We're not talking about whether he liked him or not or whether he was a good wrestler. But he said, you know what, Randy Savage to me, he's not really even a legend. That was probably one of the more infuriating emails that I've ever gotten before. Just the fact that there could be a wrestling fan out there, young or old, even somebody who didn't grow up on Randy Savage. You know, these days, compared to like years ago when myself and a lot of people grew up as wrestling fans, there's so much more access with the internet and YouTube and all these DVDs that WWE puts out, and Classics on Demand and everything, all this access to this old classic footage, there's really no excuse to not know about the legends from 10, 20 years ago. You know, there's no excuse for that, and so regardless of how young or old you might be, the fact that there's somebody out there who would say, yeah, Randy Savage, not really a legend, and he wasn't trolling, I mean, he really meant it. I could not believe the fact that somebody this stupid could possibly exist in the world, but apparently they do. Kirk writes in, I just had to tell you that I had to rewind Zack Ryder's ER joke on Raw about 10 times. It was really smart, but really corny, so it worked great. What's your thought on the joke? Well, it was really corny. And, you know, the character itself, quite frankly, that he portrays is very corny. So it lends itself to the character. He's not supposed to be taken seriously, so I had no problem. I didn't think it was funny. I thought it was somewhat clever. I didn't laugh at it, but I have no problem with it. This question comes from Paul. CM Punk. They sort of screwed him again, didn't they? His match for the title with Ziggler hardly even seemed like it was on the mid-card. And why do Big Show, Mark Henry, and Daniel Bryan keep bringing their story to Raw? I'll answer the second question first. They keep bringing their story to Raw because WWE is trying to get the SmackDown guys over on the A show. And SmackDown's ratings have been up. You know, they've had some up and down weeks recently. But for the most part, if you look at SmackDown ratings now compared to like 5 months ago or 6 months ago, the ratings are up. That's why they call it now the Raw SmackDown Super Show. They're a super show because they want the SmackDown guys on Raw because people aren't buying tickets to see the SmackDown guys at the live events and they want to get the ratings up. Now, the ratings are up, although they're still having trouble selling tickets to the SmackDown house shows. But that's why you see the SmackDown guys so much on Raw. As far as CM Punk, I got to address this. It did strike me that, you know, they didn't have the courage to put CM Punk in the main event. You had a WWE Championship match. And again, if they had booked Chris Jericho's return differently instead of doing the storyline they're doing now, if they were just going to bring him back as a heel to attack CM Punk, then yes, that main event should have been in the main event slot. And I think that's how the show would have gone off the air. But since they had other ideas for the Jericho character, you know, they didn't have anything to do with Punk and Ziggler. Just Punk and Ziggler by itself, especially with a fuck finish like that, you know, you couldn't really put that in the main event spot. The reason that Punk's not in the main event the last couple of weeks, as I mentioned earlier, is that he's proven to be ratings poison. You know, people don't like to watch CM Punk on TV by and large. People turn their TV sets off. Apparently women, for whatever reason, are really turned off by CM Punk. Boy, do they turn the channel off when he comes on. I don't know why this is. And they live and die by the numbers, so that's why it happens. But I want to address something here, because there's been a lot of people I've seen complaining about CM Punk and the fact that he's the champion and he's not what he used to be. Just people complaining and complaining and complaining about CM Punk. And there are certainly things to complain about. The character compared to the way it was back in July or August is somewhat watered down now. The biggest reason for that is that he's a babyface. You know, when that whole angle started, he was a heel. Within a couple of weeks, he had pretty much transitioned into being a babyface. But remember, he was a heel. As a babyface, you play by a different set of rules. So he's in the spot that John Cena is used to being in. He's not quite as corny and pandering to the audience as John Cena is, but he is the face of the company now as the champion. Certainly one of the faces. He's a babyface. That's the role that he's supposed to play. CM Punk is the WWE champion. He'll probably be the champion, if I had to take a guess, going into WrestleMania. As I said, the one good thing that came out of all these stupid storylines and the COO and this and that over the last couple of months is that CM Punk now is a bona fide main eventer. And the fact that so many people like to still complain and piss, bitch, and moan about it is actually kind of troubling to me. People for months and months and months begged the company to do something with CM Punk. This guy should be the champion. He should be the top guy. He's floundering with the new Nexus. Just like he was floundering when he was with the Straight Edge Society. He was a comedy character. They shaved him bald. He was feuding with Big Show. Nobody cared. And now CM Punk is the top guy in the company. He just had the TLC pay-per-view main event all to himself. Beat Alberto Del Rio, beat The Miz. He's in a storyline with John Laurinaitis now. It's the classic Austin vs. McMahon redux, but whatever. It's a big storyline. He's got the title. I mean, the people still complain. There's always going to be things to complain about. I don't want to be one of these people that you know, kowtows to WWE. Well, since CM Punk is getting a push, I'm not allowed to criticize them. Fuck that shit. You kidding me? I'm going to criticize them all the time. I'll criticize them as often as I want to if I feel I have a reason to do so. But there are people out there who will criticize for the sake of criticizing, and instead of sitting back and enjoying the fact that CM Punk is enjoying the best push he's ever had, hopefully not the best push he'll ever have, but certainly he's at the peak of his career right now, he's the champion. And people still bitch. And it just puzzles me why that is. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. And you know, when Punk loses the title, these same people are going to complain about that. Oh, they took the title off him. But you didn't seem to give a shit when they put the title on him in the first place. So the moral of the story is that apparently some people, you'll never be able to please them. I'm not saying Paul in this case is one of those people, but it just kind of set me off on a rant here because I've seen a lot of complaining on Twitter and YouTube, and I don't know where this is coming from, just like the Daniel Bryan hate. People have been really hating on Daniel Bryan lately, and not just because he's going heel, but people have been hating on him ever since he won Money in the Bank. When he won the championship before this heel turn started, people were complaining, oh my God, I can't believe they put the title on him, he sucks, he's this, he's that. But some of these same people complaining were the people that were marking out over the guy 6 months ago. So I don't really understand the logic to it, but people need to stop that. Yvonne from Melbourne, Australia writes in, been a listener since episode 54. He says, congratulations on 200 episodes of the Sound Off. Here's to 200 more. Well, thank you. I wanted to talk to you about a wrestler-related film. Surprisingly, this time it's actually good. I'm not sure if you've watched it. It's relatively popular in terms of pop culture and stars Roddy Piper. He also co-stars with Keith David, if anyone is familiar with his voice work. The movie is called They Live. Would like to hear your thoughts on this movie. It's relatively low budget, especially in comparison to WWE films these days. There are some extremely cheesy bits, but hey, it's the 1980s for you. Have I heard of They Live? What rock have you been living under? I'm just kidding. They Live is one of my all-time favorite movies. I am a big fan of John Carpenter and the original Halloween and, you know, Ghosts of Mars and some of the other movies he's done. I first saw They Live many, many years ago, and after several years of not seeing it, I actually bought the DVD in a bargain bin, I think in Walmart once or something, and a couple of years ago I watched it for the first time in a long time, and I remembered everything about it that I liked. And really, the movie has some political undertones to it. I mean, there's messages of obey and this and that. I mean, there's themes, if you look deep enough in the movie itself, that Carpenter tries to tries to impress upon people. But the movie itself actually features one of the, I think, longest fistfight scenes in the history of cinema between Roddy Piper's character and the Keith David character in the movie. It's just a fight scene that goes on and on and on, and you think it's over, and it just goes on and on and on. One of the longest, most famous fight scenes in film history is in this movie. And I really, really enjoy it. I like movies like that. You can never replicate that kind of dark, gritty feel to some of these, you know, cheesy 80s sci-fi horror movies. It's just, I guess, the way it's filmed, the way it's shot. I don't know what words to describe it. Just a different way of filming these things back in the day. I love movies like that, though. And They Live is one of my all-time favorite. I mean, have I heard of it? It's one of my favorite. As far as reviewing it one day for the Sound Off, maybe I will. I mean, I've got a couple of Match Anatomies I'm actually backed up on. I'd rather get to that first. Maybe one day I will. Maybe if other people want to hear it. Maybe on a Halloween show in the future. But They Live is an all-time classic. If you've never seen it before, I would urge you to find a copy of it and watch it. Unless you're totally not into those types of movies, if you're not into sci-fi, if you're not into horror, you probably won't like it. But Roddy Piper, for the role he plays in the movie, he's not a master thespian. He's very good. And I think that's where he originated the phrase about, I'm here to kick ass and chew bubble gum and I'm all out of gum. That comes from this movie as well. So They Live, two thumbs up, highly recommended. Tony writes into the Sound Off, I've got to say Jericho's return was one of the best crafted segments in years. Some people may hate it, but it was brilliant. He had me for a few minutes before I saw he was going way over the top. Plus, he did not do a promo, so hopefully he'll be bringing back viewers next week. It reminds me of Waylon Mercy, who was based on Max Cady from Cape Fear. I loved how the Waylon Mercy character in WWF would shake hands and then cheat. What happened to Dan Spivey after Kevin Nash broke his back? He was one of the only good things about WWF in 1995. And God, is that true. There was not a whole lot of good in WWF in 1995. In fact, there was very, very little of it. I like to joke the only good thing about 1995 for WWF is when New Year's came and the clock turned to 1996. But as far as the Waylon Mercy character, it's funny you bring that up. I was talking to somebody about that recently. You know, as a younger viewer, well, younger than I am now at the time, I never thought anything of the character. I just thought, okay, this guy's weird. He comes out. He wears a funny-looking Hawaiian shirt and these weird white pants. Well, what's so special about this guy? But, you know, you get a little older and a little bit deeper as far as some of these characters are concerned. And I like the dark nature of the Waylon Mercy character. Looking back on it, you go watch a Waylon Mercy match on YouTube, and he was a creepy MF-er, this guy. I mean, the potential for that character was really, really great. And you mentioned that Kevin Nash broke his back. I mean, I you know, Kevin Nash could be very clumsy on occasion when he executed the jackknife powerbomb. Perhaps the biggest example of this that really pissed me off when I saw it was that one WCW pay-per-view, I think it was Sold Out back in 98 or something, where he gave or tried to give the Giant, you know, the Big Show, a jackknife powerbomb, which was probably, you know, an ill-fated decision on his part to begin with. And then he probably realized mid-movie couldn't do it, and he just dropped the Big Show right on top of his fucking head and could have paralyzed the guy. But I can only blame Kevin Nash so much. I don't really know that I hold him responsible. If you go back and watch the match they had on Superstars, for those of you who don't know, the Waylon Mercy character, played by Dan Spivey, who portrayed himself as Dan Spivey early on in his wrestling career, of course, when he went to WWF, had to give him a character. And Waylon Mercy was that character. And Waylon Mercy had a match with Diesel, the WWF champion. It was a non-title match, I believe, on Superstars in 1995. And if I remember correctly, I believe Diesel was feuding with the British Bulldog at the time. Bulldog came out, or somebody came out, provided for the distraction. Diesel got counted out. So Waylon Mercy got a victory over Diesel. And Diesel comes back into the ring to attack Waylon Mercy, the sore loser that he is, and he gave him the jackknife powerbomb. You could find the footage on YouTube. Now, if you go back and watch it, it wasn't as though he picked him up for the jackknife and somehow botched the move. I mean, the move looks like it was executed perfectly fine. It was just one of those freak things that occurred. You know, Dan Spivey landed on his back. Obviously, he landed wrong. And I think he was pretty much forced to retire. I mean, he may have wrestled the match here and there after that, but that effectively, that injury ended his career at that point. He was already somewhat old and washed up already, although, again, the potential for the Waylon Mercy character was there. I don't know at that point in his career as an in-ring worker that he really could have done much more, because he was pretty well spent by that point. But we'll never know where the Waylon Mercy character would have or could have gone, because Diesel basically ended his career. But I don't really hold Kevin Nash accountable too much over that, because you watch the footage, and again, he didn't look like he botched the move. He didn't drop him the wrong way. He wasn't being reckless or careless. It looked like any other jackknife powerbomb that Kevin Nash would have delivered at the time. And, you know, Kevin Nash is a big dude. You know, a legit, if he's not a legit 7 feet, he's certainly up there at 6'10", 6'11". And you get dropped on your back and, you know, it's going to knock the wind out of you and it could have some detrimental effects on your health. And in this case, Dan Spivey's back went out. He was never the same after that. So I can blame Kevin Nash about a lot of things. People call him Big Lazy, and you could certainly point to examples of that. I don't want to beat him up too much over what happened to Waylon Mercy, just because if you watch the footage, I just don't see there being anything wrong with what he did. He did the move. And shit happens sometimes in wrestling. People get hurt. Luis from Illinois writes in, could John Cena be accused of trying to go Hollywood, as he talks about The Rock going Hollywood? Can he be accused of the same thing by appearing in feature films, or do they not count in their own minds because Vince McMahon is producing them? It's not the same thing. I mean, John Cena making The Marine, John Cena doing the film Legendary, they're WWE films. The company will go out of its way to make film roles specifically for John Cena. So, in effect, it's part of his job. They're doing this for him. He does what he's told to do. It's not an issue of Cena going Hollywood. It's an issue of Cena doing his job. So it's not the same thing. Adam from Fort Wayne, Indiana writes in, he's been a listener since episode one. I appreciate your dedication to the Sound Off. He finished listening to episode 199 and had a thought. I'm just as annoyed with Michael Cole as anyone else is, and totally agree with your comments. With all the negativity he seems to generate and the impulse to make me want to throw my TV out the window every time he opens his mouth, do you think that he has reached the level of X-Pac Heat? And if so, can we change the name from X-Pac Heat to Michael Cole Heat? Oh, Michael Cole Heat goes far beyond the realm of X-Pac Heat. I mean, Michael Cole Heat is like the devil himself is banging on the door begging to be let out type of heat. And not in a good way. Again, there's a difference between good heat and bad heat. People use the euphemism, you know, X-Pac heat. I've seen people use Boss Man heat. I used to use that. Boss Man, oh, Big Boss Man's old music from the Attitude Era would just start playing that first chord, and you would hear like a universal groan from the people in the building. There's a big difference between that, people saying, oh man, not this guy again, and Michael Cole heat, where people literally want to, forget their televisions, people are throwing themselves like stockbrokers out their windows, plummeting to their death. Paul from Guelph, Ontario writes in, likes to read the occasional mailbag on scscoops.com. Always a good thing to do. New mailbag, by the way, went up on Friday, so you might want to go back and check that out. Anyway, in Sound Off 198, somebody asked me in the mailbag to cover a match between Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit, I guess for a future match anatomy. Please, please, please don't do this. I don't know why I feel you shouldn't. Maybe it's just too soon. Like, maybe 20 years ago, you can do a podcast of crazy things from WWE over the years and say, and there was even a wrestler who killed his family and committed suicide, and it won't be so bad. What happened was a tragedy. It was not roid rage. The guy suffered so many concussions that he had the brain of an 85-year-old Alzheimer's patient. The tragedy led WWE to banning the use of chair shots on heads, but I still see a lot of stuff on TV and pay-per-views that's gotta hurt. It's not like they're even wearing helmets. The outcomes of matches might be fake and planned, but a lot of that stuff has got to hurt. I saw someone try to compare what happened to Benoit and his family to Kobe Bryant and his slip-up in Colorado. I think to some of these young guys, this stuff seems like a video game, like Grand Theft Auto. They have no comprehension how many people suffered because of Benoit. They want you to review a match between Eddie and Benoit because it will titillate them a bit. Of course, Vince struck Benoit from WWE's records. Who wants to have a bona fide murderer, suicide killer in your Hall of Fame or on your TV shows when you rerun them? When I see calls for Benoit to be in Vince's fictional Hall of Fame, I cringe. I doubt that people would have allowed OJ in the Football Hall of Fame if the selection process had taken place after he allegedly murdered his ex-wife and boyfriend. If you were a football player, would you want your picture next to OJ's or someone else who didn't kill anyone? Eddie, on the other hand, there's a story. His constant struggle with substance abuse, and I think his overwhelming them is an awesome story. I think you probably know a lot more about it than I do. Maybe I'm wrong to suggest that he would be a good story. I do know, though, that he never killed anyone and didn't commit suicide. I'd love to hear more about him in a future podcast. I'd listen to an entire podcast about Eddie Guerrero. Anyway, I love your podcast. Keep up the good work. Eddie didn't commit suicide as we would all define suicide. You can make the argument that Eddie did, in fact, kill himself by abusing his body and drugs and alcohol, and then his heart just stopped and he dropped dead one day. But I get your point. Again, if I ever decide to get to Eddie versus Benoit for a match anatomy, it's still a ways off. I've got a lot of other stuff to get to first. I've gotten opinions from people that vary. Some people want to hear me talk about that stuff or say that, you know, I could still go back and watch a Chris Benoit match on DVD. And there's a lot of people here like Paul who either don't want to or feel they can't do it. It's just too soon. I've said myself, I don't think I've watched any full Chris Benoit matches since what happened in 2007. Does that mean that I have a policy, a personal policy, where I will go out of my way not to watch his matches? Not necessarily. I mean, there have been Chris Benoit-related segments, for example, in WWE Classics, maybe, that have popped up here and there, and I've seen stuff on YouTube. One of my all-time favorite Raw matches involved Chris Benoit. It was a 10-man tag from Raw in Dallas back in 2000. It had Benoit, the Radicals, and Triple H against The Rock, Cactus Jack, Rikishi, and Too Cool. I love that match. That match I can watch, even though Benoit's in it, maybe because there's 10 guys instead of just two, I don't know. You make a very interesting point. You know, you liken, you know, Benoit possibly going into the Hall of Fame to OJ being in the Football Hall of Fame and all that. The thing about that is that Chris Benoit will never, ever be in the WWE Hall of Fame, nor should he be. You could argue that, well, it's the WWE Hall of Fame. It's not the Life Hall of Fame. And in WWE, he was well-respected, and he was a champion, and he had great matches. And that's all well and good. But you have to remember the purpose of the WWE Hall of Fame. The WWE Hall of Fame, until there is a building housing it, is a fictional part of Vince McMahon's imagination. There is no Hall of Fame. The Hall of Fame exists on a website and in the mind of Vince McMahon. And the Hall of Fame exists as a marketing vehicle for WrestleMania. It is a promotional tool for WWE. That's why people like Pete Rose and Drew Carey are in the Hall of Fame. And you'll have more celebrity inductees in the future, believe you me. It's not a legitimate Hall of Fame. It is what it is, and everybody accepts it for what it is. Why, in God's name, would Vince McMahon want to put Chris Benoit in the Hall of Fame, considering the damage that Benoit did to not just his company, think of the damage that Benoit did to the wrestling business. I don't think the wrestling business has recovered from that. I think there's still a stigma attached to wrestling about what happened in 2007. And that's on Benoit's head. That's not anybody else's fault. So, you know, the people out there who think he should be in the Hall of Fame, and even Jim Ross gets these questions all the time on Twitter, and he doesn't beat around the bush. He says, no. You know, sometimes Jim Ross will say, you know, highly unlikely to something. No, he says no. Benoit's not going in the Hall of Fame. Benoit does not deserve to go into the Hall of Fame. Benoit took two lives, one of which was a young boy, his own son. You can't turn that off. You can't pretend it didn't happen. You can't ignore that. For the people who can, those people frighten me. The fact that they can just, in their brain, somehow turn that off and ignore the fact that it ever happened and somehow pretend like it has nothing to do with his wrestling career. He had great matches. Yeah, so he had great matches. What's your point? Doesn't mean he deserves to go into the Hall of Fame. Can you imagine the outcry if they even tried to put Chris Benoit in the Hall of Fame? They have gone to great lengths to scrub his name from records, to scrub footage of him from their TV shows. They don't reference him. They don't even mention his name. Why would they put him in the Hall of Fame? Is there anybody listening to this show who honestly believes that there's even a chance of that happening? Matt writes in, I know you're sick of hearing about Undertaker vs. Sting, but I have an interesting fact. On Sound Off 108, after the 2010 WWE draft, you suggested Sting vs. Undertaker, after someone else suggested Undertaker vs. Triple H. Just thought I would let you know that. I still am in favor of Undertaker vs. Sting, as opposed to Undertaker vs. Triple H. I guess the point Matt is trying to make, the 2010 WWE draft, I guess that would make me clairvoyant, since all the Sting-Undertaker hoopla didn't happen until, February of 2011. So yeah, I've been calling for Undertaker vs. Sting for a lot longer than that. I even at the age of 53 or whatever he is now, I still think it goes back to the allure of the match, man. Sting versus the Undertaker, that's a match that could sell some pay-per-views right there, and it's a match we've never seen before. Maybe it turned out to be shit. You don't know until you try it. I'd rather see a match that we've never seen before turn to shit than a match we've seen 5 million times in the past that I'm totally sick of. Alan from Oklahoma City, do you think we get such a dull product from WWE due to the lack of competition? I just feel like if they had another company to deliver a better product than them, it would be putting on greater shows. I've just grown tired of getting basically the same thing every week. Lazy creative and the most annoying announcer in Michael Cole. What are your thoughts? You know, that's a very good point that Alan makes, and I can guarantee you one thing right now. If there was a WCW around, because TNA doesn't count, they're not threatened by TNA in the least, and TNA has their own issues, but if there was a WCW-like competitor around for WWE, especially if not just they were breathing down their neck, but if they were kicking their ass like WCW was kicking WWF's ass in the late 90s, I guarantee you this Michael Cole character, we either never would have had it, number one, or number two, the Michael Cole character would have died a death early in 2011. We would not still be sitting here listening to Michael Cole doing his shtick every single week. I guarantee you that. I'll do you one better. If there was a WCW-type competitor around, Jim Ross would still be the lead announcer on Monday Night Raw. Because there is no way that Vince McMahon would take the risk of pissing Jim Ross off by removing him from Raw and embarrassing him the way that he has, let Jim Ross's contract expire, and run the risk of him running to the competition. Jim Ross would still be calling Raw each and every Monday night. Believe me, there would be a lot of things very different right now with the WWE product, both good and bad. You know, on the bad side, we might not get people like CM Punk as WWE champion. Like I said, CM Punk has had a negative impact on the ratings. And when you have a competitor like WCW was back in the 90s, it's all about ratings. That's what the Monday Night Wars were about. Ratings, ratings, ratings. WCW kicked their ass in the ratings for 83 weeks straight, and it ate them up inside. Well, if you try to push a new guy like CM Punk, and you put the title on him, and he doesn't deliver in the ratings, CM Punk would not still be the WWE champion right now. They would have cast him aside very quickly and put the title back on John Cena or somebody else. So there's good and bad to that. But at the end of the day, the lack of competition is what hurts WWF the most. Absolutely. One of the worst things that could have happened to the wrestling industry was WCW going out of business in 2001. They deserved it. I mean, the product that WCW was delivering those last 2 years, practically all of 2000 into the beginning of 2001, was shit. I mean, it was, as I said at the beginning, an awful television program. So there was a lot of bad WCW stuff at the time. But the fact that they ceased to exist as an organization and nobody was able to come in and save them and turn that ship around, one of the worst things to happen to the history of the business. It's got to be near the top of the list. Competition drives everybody to be better. When you don't have any competition and you're the only game in town, you tend to rest on your laurels. Why try hard? We don't have to worry about anything. We're still profitable. We're still making money. TNA? Ha! TNA's not going to overtake us. They're not worried about that. But if there was another company breathing down their neck, Believe me, there's a lot of things that would be different. I'm not even sure Stephanie McMahon would still be the head of WWE Creative. I mean, it's politically, it's kind of a rough thing, because how do you fire her from that job? She's your daughter. She's Triple H's wife. But Vince McMahon, at the end of the day, when his back is up against the wall, more often than not, has done what needs to be done for the sake of his business. And I really do think that, you know, he would make the tough decisions if need be, and he wouldn't be pumping out this bullshit that we're getting on television 8 times out of 10 when Raw goes on the air each week. Matt Isaiah writes in, Happy New Year. It was a blast listening to episode 199, one of my all-time favorite episodes of The Sound Off. I especially liked your impassioned rant on Michael Cole's commentary. Thank you so much for an absolutely outstanding episode at over 2.5 hours. Or I should say roughly 2.5 hours. Do you have any information regarding the care given to Jake the Snake's snakes? Did WWE have an on-site handler? Who is responsible for feeding and housing the snakes? How are they transported from city to city? I don't believe that Jake was responsible for transporting them. But as Matt goes on to ask here in his email, you know, given Jake's personal problems, were there ever any issues of animal cruelty or negligence when he was on the road? That I'm not so sure about. I know that Jake was cited for animal cruelty, I believe, a couple of years ago. And this would have been in the last 5 years, 6 years. When he was on the road with WWE, I've heard stories about things that he would do to the snakes, whether it wasn't feeding them, treating them perhaps in ways that he should not have been treating them. There was, I think, a rib pulled at least one time that involved one of the snakes. So I can't verify any of this. They're second and third hand accounts, but I've definitely heard stories before that Jake perhaps was not always taking the best of care when it came to these snakes, which is unfortunate to hear. Not that I'm a fan of snakes, but still, mistreating animals and reptiles is not cool. Alexander writes in, first off, congratulations on 200 episodes. Two questions for you. First, would you be shocked to see Wade Barrett winning this year's Royal Rumble? Yes, I would be, actually. Second question, what are your thoughts on Booker T's in-ring work with this program with Cody Rhodes? The program appears to be over. I think the matches he had with Cody were pretty good, actually. They had a match on Raw that actually had, like, no crowd heat. And if you judge it just based on that, it was actually a shitty match. The match itself, I thought, you know, that week went, like, 12 minutes. It was pretty good. You know, the commentators were talking about the fact, you know, Booker at his age is, you know, maybe he's gassed, he's winded. They were playing off the fact that he's an old man. But that was just for the story. That was just for effect. You know, Booker was wrestling in TNA up until a few years back and was doing just fine. I thought his in-ring work was fine. In fact, he had better in-ring matches these last couple of weeks than some of the active guys on the roster in some cases. So I think Booker's work at the age of 47, I think he is now, is actually pretty good. This is coming from a guy who back in his early 40s, maybe late 30s, early 40s, I remember him doing an interview once when he was still in WCW, and they asked him, you know, when are you going to call it quits? And he said, well, you know, maybe within the next 2 or 3 years I'm planning on winding it down. That was like 10 years ago. And the guy can still go when he wants to. Maybe his knees are not quite what they used to be. He's had some knee problems over the years. But I thought Booker's work was actually pretty good. I saw nothing wrong with it. Antonio Rudolph writes in, when WWE goes on the road for live events, do they bring the wrestlers that are going to be used? Or do they bring most of the roster backstage with them? I believe it's just the wrestlers that they're going to use when it comes to the house shows. There may be a few extra bodies there, of course, in the event of an injury or a last-minute replacement or whatnot. But I don't believe it's a majority of the roster that's backstage. I don't know that with 100% certainty. But it's my impression that, you know, as far as it's most of the roster there, whether it's Raw or SmackDown, you know, there's a lot of people backstage, more than sometimes are, you know, just the people appearing on the actual card. But I don't think the entire roster is there. And in some cases, they'll do these split shots where you may have one Raw show, let's say, in one city and then another Raw show in a different city. Of course, on those days, you're essentially splitting the roster. Obviously, they're not all going to be in the same place, so it varies. Blackleg from the Philippines writes in, congratulations on 200 entertaining sound-offs. It's been a while since the last time I wrote in, but there was no way in hell I'll miss participating on a landmark sound-off. To be honest, this email is more of a congratulatory one than a inquisitive one, but my question is, which two current WWE wrestlers should align themselves and form a tag team? I know you're not much of a fan of the makeshift tag team approach, but I'm sure subconsciously the thought came to your head. Well, not really. Let me know what you think about this idea. How about Mark Henry and Brodus Clay? They can be the modern-day natural disasters. They can play on the story going around that the Hall of Pain concept used by Henry was the brainchild of Clay and call themselves the Inductors. Hell, they had previous nicknames such as Silverback and G-Rilla. Perfect fit, right? What do you think? Silverback, by the way, one of the worst nicknames to give somebody for obvious reasons, but modern-day natural disasters, I'd have to say no thank you. Not that I wouldn't mind seeing Mark Henry and Brodus Clay just beat the shit out of everybody in their wake, but to become a tag team in WWE right now, until they've done enough to really bolster that division, I'm not a fan of taking somebody like Mark Henry, who is so damn good in his current role. I'd be more in favor of making Mark Henry a permanent announcer on the SmackDown brand than I would putting him in a tag team, just because I feel he can at least quiet Michael Cole down for the rest of us. But, you know, it's really death to a person's career when you do that. You know, Brodus Clay, if he ever does actually debut, I think if they build him up as a monster, can be a good singles monster. Mark Henry is fine in his current role. I think it would be a huge step down, just like it was when he put him in the tag team with MVP. You know, Mark Henry and MVP were a tag team for quite some time. I don't think they ever actually won the tag belts. That certainly didn't do any favors for either man's career. So I wouldn't want to do that again to Mark Henry. I think he's better than that. But like I said, the idea of the two of them going around kicking ass is certainly a pretty cool idea. I just don't like the idea of actually making them an official tag team. And the last email here on episode 200 comes from, an appropriate person, Howard Kroom. And it's appropriate because Howard actually has the distinction of saying that he was the last question that was used in the mailbag on episode 100. And so now he will have that distinction again here on episode 200, one of our longtime listeners. This comes from Howard. Sound Off has become one of those things that make me realize how fast time flies. When I hear you talk about the 5-year Scott Hall prediction being a couple of years old, I really can't believe that it's already been a couple of years. I used to be annoyed by the posts on SE Scoops for the Sound Off because I wasn't interested in listening to some corny wrestling radio show. After seeing the post for a couple of weeks, I finally listened to an episode somewhere in the mid-30s. And then, when I finished it, I downloaded all of the ones that I had missed up until that point. I started listening back in the day, when the big news was that Ring of Honor might be getting a TV deal in the near future. I'm talking about the old days, the pre-Facebook, pre-Twitter, and pre-the mailbag is so full that your question won't be answered on the air for a couple of weeks old days. Well, that's still the case now. I used to hear you say that some people would write to you and say that they don't watch the product on TV anymore, but instead they have opted to use your show as their wrestling fix every week. I never thought I'd say this, but I've become one of those people. I go to school full-time, work part-time, have a social life, and absolutely cannot spend my time watching these shows on TV anymore. This is not an exaggeration. I listen to episode 199 and then turn to the USA Network to see the return of Chris Jericho on Raw. And I did not even get far enough into the show to hear one single word of it. John Cena came out, looked around, cracked that damn smile, and then I have no idea what happened the rest of the show because I never turned back after I saw that smile. There probably were good things on this show, but the opening 10 seconds took away any chance I had to leave my TV on USA to find out. I feel like my free time is so limited that I can't even spend it doing things like watching a Monday Night Raw with the exact same format, philosophy, and direction that it's had for years, especially when the later years and months have been awful, even to the diehards. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but it seems like their business model is designed around worsening their product, and they have been succeeding at doing that. How do you convince people that your champion is a joke and they wouldn't want to tune in to watch him? You tell them that in plain English, and that is exactly what they do. My question that I need answered is this. What DVDs should I show someone who wants to become a wrestling fan but knows nothing about the product past or present? This question has been partly answered in the past, but I want to make it more specific. If you, the Solo Monster, were dating a girl who wanted you to get her into wrestling as a fan, it's a good thing you said as a fan, by the way, because I was going to say, if she was your girlfriend and you got her into the wrestling business, you could kiss her goodbye. But okay, as a fan, which DVD would you choose? Where would you start? It's a subjective question with no right answer, so that is why I want to know what you would do, because I'm going to regard that as the best answer. I guarantee that this question will lead to at least one sound-off-inspired marriage, so someone's future is relying on this. Thank you for all the hard work you put in for the fans, If it wasn't for this show, some of us would be completely removed from the current product, and I don't know what would bring us back, unless they did a 60-minute Iron Man match between Mark Henry and The Big Show. How dare you mention such an idea? Don't you know there could be people from WWE listening to this right now? You're putting bad ideas in their head. As far as DVDs to recommend, there's been a whole bunch of DVDs WWE has done. There's actually been a bunch of wrestling DVDs as well. There was a world-class documentary that was done that was independent of WWE. But, I mean, as far as like a girl or trying to introduce a friend who's not really a wrestling fan to begin with, I don't think they would really give a shit about, you know, the history of world-class championship wrestling. To be honest with you, I would almost mislead them in a way. And what I mean by that is, one of the better DVDs to show them would probably be the Monday Night War DVD. The Monday Night War DVD shows some of the best and worst, but some of the best of WWF and WCW at their peak when they were going head-to-head during one of the most exciting periods in the history of wrestling. I would want to show people the best of wrestling. I would want to show people why wrestling can be so exciting and unpredictable the way it used to be. I mean, they don't need to know that the product right now, for the most part, I don't want to say the product right now is crap, but the product is missing a lot of those exciting elements right now. I don't want people to know that. I mean, they'll find that out on their own. The Monday Night War DVD is a good possibility. The new Stone Cold Steve Austin DVD that I reviewed a couple of weeks ago on Sound Off, that new 4-disc DVD set that came out, The Bottom Line, I think it's called. It's about Steve Austin specifically, but that's a really kick-ass DVD release right there. I mean, it was long. The documentary is like over 2 hours long, and it kept my interest the entire time. And, I mean, what better person to feature to somebody who knows nothing about wrestling than one of the all-time most popular performers in the history of wrestling? I mean, Steve Austin was a no-nonsense, take-no-shit, take-no-prisoners, rebellious, anti-authority type character that people love. So, the Steve Austin DVD, in my opinion, showcases every bit of what makes wrestling so fun and enjoyable. So the Monday Night War DVD would be one. The Steve Austin DVD that just came out would be another one. The Rise and Fall of ECW would be another good one as well. Not everybody, you know, ECW is not everybody's cup of tea. And I think if you're talking about a female fan, you know, ECW, the original one, might turn more females off than turn them on. I said turn them on. Not in that way. I didn't mean that. But those are some of the DVDs I would look at first. I mean, there's been a lot of good ones they've released. The one on Eddie Guerrero back in the day. There's been, you know, some DVDs even recently. The John Cena Experience. All the John Cena fans out there raved about that one. Randy Orton just had a DVD come out. The Evolution of a Predator or something, I think it's called. But those, you know, to a new fan, they're not going to care about that. The Monday Night War, the new Steve Austin DVD, Those are two of the ones, and I'll give you one more. I'll give you one more. The Ultimate Ric Flair Collection. The original Ric Flair DVD set that WWE did. They actually did two of them. I think the second one was called the Definitive Ric Flair DVD Collection. The first one they came out with, I believe, was called the Ultimate Ric Flair DVD Collection. If you watch that DVD and you don't come out of it entertained and thinking, God damn, this guy's one of the greatest of all time, you're probably not suited to be a wrestling fan. I mean, any real wrestling fan, whether you're a big fan, whether you're a casual fan, I don't see how anybody could watch that DVD and not be entertained by at least half of what's on there. I mean, there's so much good, there's great matches, there's entertaining promos. I mean, God, Ric Flair, one of the all-time great promo guys, he could be entertaining as anybody. All that stuff is on there. One of the best DVDs they ever put out. So that would probably be in no particular order in my top three. The Monday Night War, the Ultimate Ric Flair Collection, and the Stone Cold Steve Austin Bottom Line DVD that just came out. Those are three fine, fine choices for a person who has never been exposed to the wrestling business before. I think that's a good place for them to start. And again, Howard, thank you for writing in. I appreciate that. I was wondering where you've been. I haven't gotten a letter from him in a while, but I think it's appropriate that he ends the mailbag on the centennial of the Sound Off, and he also ends the mailbag here on the bicentennial. So that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. If you have questions, email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. The people who I did not get to, I will either try to respond to you directly, or I will get your question on the next show. Sorry I couldn't get to it this time. I did as much as I could. But again, thesolemonster@gmail.com is the place to send me any messages. You can tweet me or follow me on Twitter as well, twitter.com/solemonster, facebook.com/thesolemonster. And you can subscribe to the show in iTunes. I would very much appreciate any Bicentennial Sound Off reviews in iTunes if you want to post one up there. It's very easy to do so if you have an account with iTunes, as many people who have an iPod or an iPhone do. All you got to do is look up the show in iTunes on your device, and it may prompt you to put your password in. You need an account, obviously. You put your password in, and click on the Reviews tab. And at the very top will be a button called Write a Review. You click that button, you can rate the show on a scale of 1 star to 5 stars and write anything you want to in there. So you can leave me a review in iTunes, and I would very much appreciate that. I have a YouTube channel as well. If you look for the username The Solomonster, that is my official YouTube channel, the one and only. You can subscribe to that one. Anytime I put up any funny little promos or future sound-offs on there, you'll be the first people to know about it. So get on there as well. And that's going to do it. Episode 200 in the books, long anticipated. It's finally over. We can move on. Episode 201 next weekend. I did have one kind of fun little announcement here. It's fun for me, maybe not fun for you, but I thought I would mention it here, that I am, in fact, going to WrestleMania this year. It was not something I had originally planned on, and I am, in fact, going to attend WrestleMania 28. In Miami on April 1st. I am very much looking forward to it. I've got my ticket to Sun Life Stadium. It might not be the best ticket. I might be a couple of miles away from the ring. And I've never been to this particular stadium before. In fact, I've never been to a stadium WWE show before. I think the biggest crowd probably I've ever been to is probably the Garden. I've been to a couple of other places. I think the Garden might be the biggest, and that's, I mean, 19,000 people. WrestleMania, you're talking about 60 to 70,000 people, so it should be interesting. I'll be down there. I know Webmaster Mike, of course, will be down there. Noah Mark, the entire SC Scoops family will be down there, and I'm happy to be joining them for WrestleMania 28 this year. Very excited. In all the years I've been a fan, I've never once attended a WrestleMania. The closest I've ever come was attending the very first fan festival they had, which was at Madison Square Garden in the Rotunda in the basement. The weekend of WrestleMania 10, I did not actually attend WrestleMania 10. I would have very much enjoyed that. And after all these years, this will be my first WrestleMania. I can't think of a better place to fly down to than Miami. So I'm looking forward to that. And that'll make for an interesting post-show sound-off when I give my live event experience at WrestleMania 28. So I figured I would mention that here. If you are going to WrestleMania as well, I hope you have a good time. Perhaps I'll see some of you down there. But I just wanted to mention that. And on that note, we're going to wrap up the show this week. We'll be back next week. Again, I want to thank each and every person listening to this show. I say this a lot, but I mean it. And after 200 episodes, I mean it now more than ever. When I started this, I had no idea that I'd ever do 200 of these things. You know, I did almost 60 shows last year. I sit here for hours on end recording these things. There's good weeks, there's bad weeks, but at the end of the day, we're all wrestling fans. I enjoy the hell out of doing this. I enjoy the hell out of interacting with you guys, getting emails from you guys, all the stuff on Twitter and Facebook that I plug and all that. That's a lot of fun, too. You got to get on there. I really appreciate that, and hopefully we'll do another 200 of these things going forward. You know, I could do this forever in a day because I love doing it, and I wish I could do this full-time for a living. That's how much I love doing it, so thanks to each and every one of you for making this show as fun as it is, and even to the trolls and the people who love to post stupid comments on SC Scoops and all that. I love all of you, too. So until next time, we're going to end this the way we always do. Be well. Stay safe. We'll see you right back here next week for another edition of the Solomonster Sounds Off right here on SEScoops.com.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joe from Northern Ireland.
I am AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.